So we're discussing the issue of Malan HaSinai. As to, first of all, how do we have knowledge? Since this is the foundation of our whole system, our acceptance of Torah. So how do we have knowledge today that the event took place? And the start is, why was the event itself necessary? If you go through the stories, you see that, well, first of all, you see one thing, that at no point in the Torah, at no point, is there any idea that it's meritorious or it's praiseworthy that people should accept that a certain individual is a prophet, or that they should accept that something is from God without proof? Because even before Matan Torah, when God first appeared to Moshe and instructed him to go to Mitzrayim, yeah, so Moshe had the whole debate at the snare, the burning bush. But then Moshe at one point says, "Behem lo yaminu," they won't believe in me. That is to say, and the Rambam discusses this whole thing in the Torah, that first Moshe had to be able to convince them that he had the correct idea of God that they had. That was he asked, "What's your name?" I said, "That's Ekya Asher Ekya." So then he would be able to elucidate the concept, the idea of God that they possessed. But that's not enough. Because that doesn't prove, just because a person, an individual, happens to have the correct notion, the correct idea of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, that doesn't prove that God has actually communicated with him. So that's why he said, "Behem lo yaminu." They'll say, "God didn't speak to you." Now, right then and there, you see that there's no idea that people should accept things on the basis of faith. Because God doesn't say to him, "Well, what do you mean? That's it, they should have faith in you." There's no such concept. It's perfectly legitimate. To the contrary, you see that God provides them with actual demonstrations. So by doing so, doesn't that establish the idea that people are not expected? It would be wrong for people to simply accept somebody and because of any other factor than to be demonstrated. Why should... That idea is at the bottom of what that whole discussion is about. You must produce that. But since God didn't tell Moshe, "Forget, don't worry about that, let's see it down the moon. Let's see it down the moon." And you have to assume also that the knowledge, this idea that the Jews would someday be redeemed from Mitzrayim, that must have been passed down to them. Because that's the message he said, that God is... remember, so to speak, that God has not abandoned you, and God is going to come and save you, and all of that. That was the message he brought to them. That message itself must have resonated with them, must have some, which, you know, they had traditions that they had received. But that didn't mean anything. The question would be, which was a legitimate question, how do we know that God spoke to you, Moshe Rabbeinu? Moshe. So, right then and there, the fact God gave you three signs to demonstrate that he was indeed in contact with the Supreme Being, because otherwise how could he be responsible? How could he predict the phenomenon? You want to use the word perform the miracles, but by performing the miracles, he wasn't saying that he had a specific power. It was, as we pointed out many times, the fact that he could predict at what point in time this change in nature would take place. It would mean that he's in contact with the Supreme Being. After that point, you see there's a certain development in terms of the relationship between Moshe and the Jews in the tribe. That they accepted what he said, and they, you know, there's the tide seems to go up and back. When things went badly with Paro, and Paro increased the work, so they turned against Moshe. And that's understandable. But eventually, in the course of the year, it's about a year, approximately a year, that Moshe spent in Mitzrayim, with the Makros, with the weakening of the Mitzrayim, and the complete change in attitude that took place towards the Jews, paying her on, the people had a new respect for the Mitzrayim. The Mitzrayim had a new respect for the Jews and Moshe Rabbeinu, and then you see that they rallied behind Moshe. And they had the courage to take the seh when they were commanded to for the Korban Pesach, and to ask the Mitzrayim as they were instructed to for the gifts, to line up to get ready and to actually leave the Yad Rama with the high hand. See, and then all subsequent to that, all the things that took place in the Midbar before Sinai. Moshe had performed other miracles, but it would seem that the most significant of all of them was the miracle of the Kriyas Yamta. And by the way, before that, when God tells them to turn around and go back to Pi Achiros, and it says that the Jews did all of that, so Rashi points out that to teach you there, to compliment them, that's their praise, that in spite of the fact that they were going towards the enemy, they still said, we have nothing except the word of Moshe. That shows that they had fully accepted the idea that Moshe was the Navi of Hashem. So, for all of these reasons, the question then arises, so why wasn't that enough? And then God asked them, sent Moshe to ask them if they wanted to receive the Torah. And they said yes, without condition. Nevertheless, that was not enough. And God said, I'm going to come to you in a thick cloud, thickness of cloud, so that the people will hear. And when I speak with you, and also in you, they will believe la'olah. So that trust itself is giving us the basic objective, the basic purpose of what the Nama, the revelation itself, was all about. I said, the first question is that if we assume that the Jews already believe in God and believe in Moshe, so wouldn't this entire demonstration be superfluous? Now the Rambam explains the reason why it was necessary and what the purpose is. And basically, that it would seem that there are two reasons why the revelation, in which they saw these tremendous sights and sounds and so forth, everything which they perceived to be supernatural phenomena, things that could not have been arranged, orchestrated by people, and most significant, they heard the voice of God from heaven. They heard a voice from heaven, which they were convinced was not a human voice, and it was commanding them in these ideas, in these mitzvahs. So there are two factors. One factor is that a person who believes on the basis of miracles, that belief in and of itself is not perfect, so to speak. The Ramzi is sort of like Yesh Acharei Hiro. It's not completely convincing. It has an effect, you see, it's not to be completely dismissed, because on the basis of these miracles, the Jews did follow Moshe Rabbeinu. But, which means to say it's rational, that if you were in that situation, and Moshe had performed these various miracles, so it would make sense to follow, which the Jews did. But, in terms of giving the Torah, and producing an absolute conviction, so miracles, even the greatest of them, seem to be lacking something, and that was one of the reasons why Ma'amon Har Sinai is going to provide, is going to restore that which would be lacking in ordinary miracles. Miracles, in general, while they make a very powerful impact upon a person, generally speaking, they don't produce anything which is lasting. Because you have to understand there's a lot of resistance in the human psyche. There's a lot of resistance. And after time, you can sort of like rationalize what it does. Because it depends upon a certain type of an association. You never really, it doesn't satisfy the mind completely, because you're just making a certain assumption that this is not a coincidence. That you were in a desperate situation and had given up all hope, and then a certain event had occurred. So you're making a certain deduction, that therefore there must be a God and so on and so forth. But you never really get direct access to that. That's by inference. It's an inference that the mind makes. And it's a correct inference, and it's logical. Actually. You don't know if it's correct. You don't know if it's correct, but it's logical. Given all the circumstances, so. Given those circumstances, if you were in a situation like that, where you were facing tremendous danger of your being overwhelmed by enemy forces, and then somebody came along and told you not to worry, everything will be okay, you will see, in 1 hour's time, there's going to be an earthquake on that side, and it will be consumed, you know, that type of thing. If you were to see all of that, there's no question that it will make a tremendous impact upon you, and if you function purely intelligently, you assume, you say you do less. It doesn't make sense to assume that it's a chance phenomenon, and you would deduce, therefore, that there must be a supreme, there must be this, there must be this, there must be that. But don't you understand, that depends upon a person who's very, very rational, but because of the fact that you have to make all of those steps, and those steps that you're making are not things that you are witnessing directly, you're not witnessing the underlying cause behind it, that because of the way the psyche is structured emotionally, it leaves room for doubt, so that when other emotions come to the fore, and now you have desires, which would be contrary to the truth that you'd have to live by if all of those deductions were actually true. So then you see the emotions begin to overpower a person. Yeah, well, you know, who knows? Maybe it was a coincidence. Maybe this person knew about the geological factors. Even though that is irrational, even though it would be irrational, not that way, because you should, whatever is the logical conclusion, whatever the logical conclusion should be, is one that you should actually live by. But the nature of Adam is that he doesn't do that. He doesn't do that, and when there is a powerful urge to act in accordance with certain instincts, and however, there's another part of him which is saying, no, I have to fear God, I'm violating what God has commanded. So then you have the phenomenon of the rationalization and the distortion factor beginning to turn. You see how people can distort reality. So there is a difference then between a situation where you arrive at the idea of a supreme being through certain inferences, as opposed to where you come in direct contact. That is, the supreme being manifests itself directly, and if you're not basing yourself on the fact that how could this event occur unless there was a supreme being? You're face to face. That's what Moshe tells the Jews in the Vermont. God spoke to you directly. And that's the appeal. The appeal of the Torah really rests on this, that you must keep the Torah because you have direct knowledge that it was given to you by God. Nowhere does Moshe ever appeal to the Jews to keep the Torah because you just should have faith. No, it says that not just our fathers, but we ourselves. That's the idea, in my opinion, that all the Jews, the souls of all the Jews around Sinai, means to say that God created this event, and it was worked out in such a way that it would provide absolute proof that the Torah comes from God, not just for those people who witnessed it. So that's step one. Step one is you need to know why it is that it was necessary for those people who witnessed it when they had witnessed so many other miraculous phenomena. In evaluating what the Jews actually witnessed, at Sinai, they witnessed supernatural phenomena. They witnessed supernatural phenomena, and they heard a voice which they were convinced, whoever was there would have been convinced, came from God, addressing them, that this is my will. This is the, I am the Lord your God. So therefore that teaches you all these vital points. I'll get into what we do. We do the actual exercise of biblical, we'll go into the idea of what the concept is. But bear in mind that even today, I don't think it's possible to have such a spectacle, to get an entire nation, millions of people, and have a situation where they themselves would walk away convinced that they just had an encounter with the supreme being. And this is in the age of technology. See, people have a tremendous... You'll understand why there's a significance. The importance of this proof is, even upon hearing this proof, you see how people rationalize and try to distort it and try and spin it around and negate its significance. Oh, well, you know, this is a few thousand, maybe they were so primitive, maybe, you know, like they were frightened, maybe there was really a volcano, all that kind of stuff. See, first of all, you have to realize, I don't think that modern technology could create a thing like this. Today, with all the technologies that we have, you could not take people and convince them that they had, because people would, that they had witnessed something. You know, you can make all kinds of fireworks and displays and so on and so forth, but people witnessing it would know, would be able to recognize that this is a production. But certainly in those days, they didn't have that kind of capacity. There was no technology. So nobody could do it. You read the story in the Torah itself. So a lot of people say, oh, of course, I mean, if I was there, of course I would, those people that were there, yeah, of course, but I'm not there. But if you read the description of what actually transpired, and you put yourself in that situation, and you still would not be convinced, so then there's nothing to be said. I mean, the Torah is not speaking to a person like that. This is that would imply that such an individual was like, you know, had some kind of a distortion. Could not. A person that was there, that was at Sinai and witnessed what he witnessed and heard what he heard and just negated it, that person has a problem. That's to read the description in the Varm, the people were clearly convinced that it came from God, because then they say they got emotion. They say we can't, if we continue, now we see that a person can hear the voice of God and live. That's what they say to Moshe Rabbeinu. And then they say, now you go, and if we continue to hear this, then we'll die. They were afraid that they would die, because it could do such a powerful impact upon them. To be in that state of proximity to God was such that they can only bear so much. And they said, now that's it, it's fulfilled its objective. That is, now we don't need to be hearing the Torah anymore directly from God. We have absolute conviction that you, Vidam Mechayam, really are them, that you're the one. Because they saw that Moshe was unique, that God addressed himself to Moshe, and Moshe went into the Arafel, and so forth. So that was another one of the objectives. There were two objectives. One is that the Torah comes, the second one is Gam Mechayam, that God is not going to come to the Jews every day with messages. It's going to be through the ones who he has determined, his chosen ones, so to speak, the Nevi'im, and then followed by the Baalei HaMasorah, all the other Nevi'im, and the Baalei HaMasorah, and so on and so forth. But God established a system by which the Jews would constantly be receiving, you know, his prophecy, the message that God wanted them to have, and also the interpretation, the legitimate interpretation. And you see that was fulfilled, because in Devarim Moshe tells them that you came to me and you, that's it, you, so to speak, had enough. The first objective then was that the people itself should base their acceptance of the Torah not merely on the fact that miraculous phenomena have been performed, but rather direct communication from the Supreme Being. The second point that's made by the Rambam and the Ramban also is that by establishing the foundation this way, the Jews, as opposed to miracles, the Jews were thereby protected against the possibility of a false prophet. Now, a false prophet ever coming along and undermining the foundations of Yahadus. That is to say, if our acceptance of the veracity of Torah was based upon the fact that the one who gave it to us was able to perform miracles. So we accept it because of the miracles that he performed. So then there's a portion of the Torah that warns against the false prophet. That if a prophet should ever arise, another shekhar, and he tells you something which is contrary to Torah, that God is commanding you to do something which is contrary to Torah. Now, let's assume that he performs great miracles. So you question him, you doubt him, and so you're not just going to accept it. And you tell him, well, we can't believe you because we accept the Torah, because we know the Torah comes from God, so you have to be false. So let's say it was based upon miracles. The foundation was just miracles. So then he would say, well, how do you know that what you were told then is true? And you would say, well, because of the miracle. So then Sarah performed miracles too. So let's say for whatever reason he's able to perform miracles. So now you'd be in a real dilemma. Because how do you know that the Torah of Moshe is to be accepted over him? Let's assume that his miracles are equally impressive. Let's assume he can split a sea. Or whatever it is you want to put him to the test. Now the Torah maintains that a thing like that is possible. But the rest, how is it possible? There's no human being. Either a person is tremendously gifted and can create illusions and fool you. That's one possibility. That somebody should develop this tremendous skill of making something appear. And today, with, you know, illusions, they can really create these kinds of impressions. Or else it's possible that God is testing you. That's what the Rambam says. So God is testing you. So that it is possible that a false prophet, should arise and try to dissuade us or try to convince us, seduce us into some type of a practice which would be contrary to Torah. It could be something which would be idolatrous. That we should make some kind of an image and put it up in the synagogues, and not to pray to an image, but we should have that thought in mind when we do it through. Something which would be on the verge of idolatry, whatever it is, which would be totally, absolutely contrary to Torah. Now, if the foundation of Torah itself was, we believed it because the one who gave it to us performed the miracles, so now you'd be in a state of tremendous vulnerability. Because if somebody else should ever come along and create the same type of miracles, or entrust us that he had created the same type of miracles, with a message which is contrary, so then how would you know who to follow? You could not refute the false prophet. It wouldn't make any sense. Why would he be a false prophet? Maybe the first prophet is false, because they both could be miracles. It's been the only reason you believe the first one is because of miracles. Now, he did miracles. So the first one says that that what the second person is saying is false. Yeah, but by the same token, the second one is saying that God never commanded that. So you'd be stuck. So the Rambam compares this to the case of witnesses of Abraham. Well, the Torah commands us that we have to decide cases on the basis of Abraham. And of course you have to go through all the interrogations and so on and so forth to make sure they're not lying. But once the witnesses have passed the test, the interrogations, so then you have to accept the testimony and you have to decide the case on the basis of their testimony. But does that mean to say that just because you weren't able to break them down and they passed the test of the breach of Hakira, does that mean that they're telling the truth? No. It's a halacha. It's a halacha because it's possible that they're lying, but they're very adept, they're very skillful, very, very knowledgeable, and they're able to fool the justices. The judges. That's why if the second pair of witnesses comes along and contradicts the first, so then you don't know who's telling the truth. You have to throw the case out. However, the only person that would be in such a situation that, let's say he accepted something and acted on the basis of testimony of witnesses, which was thoroughly investigated and so forth, and then he was convinced on that basis, and therefore they put a certain person in jail or whatever, they executed the person, whatever the case may be. Then you have two witnesses come along and testify to something the exact opposite. They contradict the testimony of the first. So now, assuming that you use the same methods of interrogation with the second pair, you're in a situation of that. You have no way of knowing. Okay? That would be the same situation if we accepted Moshe on the basis of miracles. So with regard to that, we'd be just as vulnerable if somebody else came along with miracles and had a totally different message. We wouldn't know which message is true anymore, because he only accepted the first message because of miracles. But let's say that you you're the judges. It just so happens that you, who are the judge, then the two witnesses come, and they testify about something, and you yourself were there. And you yourself were there at that place, in that room, at that time, in that situation, and they claim that one person assaulted another person. So, would you, in this situation, would you accept what they say as being any validity? Just because they're witnesses? No, because you're not going to accept something, someone as a witness, when it contradicts that which you yourself saw with your own eyes. You see? So there's no way in the world, I mean, if hundreds and hundreds of witnesses came and testified about something, and you were there, and you saw it yourself, so then you don't need witnesses, you don't need any proof. You know that what they're saying is false. You automatically would reject them. You wouldn't have to have an interrogation. With these people, you would not have to have an interrogation in order to prove that they're false witnesses, because you know by definition that they're false witnesses, because you were at the event itself. That's the difference over here. That in the first case, the reason why you believe the Torah of Moshe is not because of the miracles that Moshe performed. It's because you know the directly. You know, you have first-hand knowledge that whatever has been commanded comes from God. So this is God's will. So now if somebody else should come along and tell you that God wants something contrary, you say it has to be false, because you heard directly what God wants. I like to perform miracles. So you perform all the miracles you want. It's not, we're not accepting the Torah because of miracles. We're accepting it because we heard it. We know that it's true because we're there ourselves. And you're not going to convince us through an inferior method about something which goes contrary to that which we witnessed ourselves. By establishing the Torah on this basis, it made us no longer vulnerable to the possibility of being seduced by a false prophet. That's why the Torah says that if such a thing should ever occur, and it's possible that there would be a phenomenon of a false prophet, that God is really testing us to see whether you truly love God. That is to say, whether your relationship to God is based upon a firm foundation of your idea, of knowledge. Yes, all these things you see is the extent to which the real foundation for our acceptance of Torah is based upon your idea. And that the idea, which we produce through miracles, is insufficient. But the Rambam says that Moshe Rabbeinu, the Jews did not believe him because of the Osos that he did. And that's the Rambam talks about this in Historia Torah. Now we're in a position to understand what the necessity, what necessitated the Mama, Mama Hasina. Because it established the conviction that the Torah comes from a Kodesh Baruch Hu, that God is the source of the Torah, and that his trusted servant, the one who's trusted, who's Ma'amon, to transmit to us is Moshe Rabbeinu, that he's designated Moshe Rabbeinu, and therefore whatever Moshe Rabbeinu tells us in the name of God, we should accept as the Torah. Now we understand why this was all necessary, because it put it on a different level of Yediyah, which was no longer subject to any kind of doubt, and which was no longer subject to any other kind of refutation. Indeed, there's only one possible way. After the Torah was given to him, there'd only be one possible way for any other false prophet. That's why every, so to speak, prophet, all the false prophets of the other religions, whether it's Jesus, whether it's Muhammad, and so forth, all of the other imposters, well, I don't believe that they performed anything worse in terms of miracles. There's no evidence whatsoever that they did anything of significance. But even if they had done so, we would reject them, because we would say to them, we were there. We heard God say that this is the Torah. And, after the Torah is given this way, the question, just throwing out the question in order to obtain an understanding, and the Rambam refers to it in one of his letters. Would it be now conceivable for there to be any type of a way in which we doubt, real doubt, could be established somewhat. Because we see that the whole purpose was to make it really beyond the realm of doubt. It was, I'm showing you again the direction that well, those people want to maintain the faith, simple faith. To the contrary, it's really knowledge, and to the extent where it's a kind of knowledge which does not lend itself to any kind of doubt whatsoever. The only way that we could ever be rendered vulnerable, and it's never happened, no one even tried to do it, is if somebody would come forth and say that it's God's will to aid us. He couldn't say, there's nothing that could make a point that the soul was not given by God. He couldn't do that. The only thing he could say is that it was intended for a time and now there's a change. Which doesn't make sense either, because the Torah itself is very clearly different forever. And why would God the change? If God had the law of the world of purpose, why would it change? How can he prove it? The only way to prove it is then something. You know, the Rambam reverse of that. Fine, if you can demonstrate to us in the same way, if you can create the same phenomena that were the foundations for which we accepted.
So
if you could gather together millions of people. Well, no, we even said this, we want to hear directly from God. You see, because when we heard directly from God that this is the Torah, this is God's will. And so that's why we keep the Torah and we can't make any changes, because it comes to us from God.
So how do you know from God?
Because you were there. See now. Now, if you're claiming that that was only intended to be temporary, or there's going to change of course now, we go in a different direction, so we'll say, well, you have to prove it to us. The only way you can prove it to us could not be through miracles. So you would have to create a situation which is akin, which is analogous to the original situation, and we would hear directly from God, so then we would listen. But you see quite clearly that if nobody remotely ever, with all the deviations that people are sort of introduced into Torah, no one has ever remotely even wanted to get into an arena where he could do any kind of demonstration. The truth of the matter is that there's nobody that we know of that even was able to perform any kind of a miracle that we would give any credence to. And even today, we have a tremendous amount of charlatans in the area of religion in general. Miracles, people have claims to miraculous powers and all of that. Yet, there's nobody that is willing to come forth in an open manner, which the miracles of Moshe Rabbeinu were all performed openly, and we say even those miracles are not sufficient as the ultimate guarantor that the Torah is true. But what you have is, it's, everything is done hidden, and you have these people that stories are told and projected and exaggeration and so on and so forth, so that of all of these people, and they're all far away, they all have everything in miracles. Miracles to us for everything in the world, but they can't make it public, and they can't do it in front of, it's a secret. So what I'm saying is that all of this should be completely rejected. In terms of a real assault on the veracity of Torah, nothing of any true significance has ever been launched. Unfortunately, people in this area are completely irrational. And false religion, which tried to establish their origin in Sina. All the major religions have to go back to Sina, because there's no way that they can make a duplication. There's no way that they can have what we would call a public revelation. That's an impossibility for people to do unless it's real. The phenomenon of a public revelation is impossible to create, and if it does exist, it must be real. Rambam says that the miracles that Moshe performed were not done to establish his veracity, to establish the truthfulness of Torah. Rather, each one was done because of the situation required. That is to say, Kriya Shamsuk was not done to establish the veracity of Moshe Rabbeinu, even though the result of that was that the belief in Moshe Rabbeinu increased. Still, that was not the purpose of the miracle. The purpose of the miracle, it's because of necessity. And that's all the miracles that were performed by Moshe Rabbeinu were done because of a certain necessity. For example, the man, they needed food. So the man was a great miracle. But it wasn't done to establish veracity. And that's where the Rambam learns the pasuk that Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu at the very beginning of the dialogue by the snare, by the burning bush. So he said, "Botziach es am Mitzrayim tavdun es holokim al harazeh." And the Rambam interprets that to mean that the ultimate verification, that what you speak is really true, it comes from God, will be on Sinai. The event at Sinai, therefore, was intended to establish on a level which is beyond miracles. It is not to say that they were impressed by the miracle. It was not to dismiss the significance of a miracle. The Jews did follow Moshe Rabbeinu. On the basis of the fact that he was so nervous, because that's what he asked God, "Hey, may I mean it? But they won't believe in me when I come to them and declare that I'm a prophet." So why should they believe that God spoke to me? So for that, it was necessary to provide him with supernatural phenomena, which indicated that he was connected to a source which is beyond the physical realm. So therefore you can't dismiss miracles. And the point over here is not to dismiss miracles and say they have absolutely no value. They do have a value. And they work because as a result of the miracles, the signs that Moshe performed, and the Jews followed him, and then he went to Pharaoh. And God said, "When Pharaoh demands a sign, this is what you should do." And those are the makos. The makos were not just punishments, but they were intended not as punishments, to direct his attention to the fact that there's a supreme being who rules the world with justice. There is then a certain type of an ambivalence over here with regard to miracles. So what are we saying? Is it rational to follow an individual on the basis of miracles? Or isn't it? You can't say that it's irrational. You can't say it doesn't make sense to follow a person on the basis of miracles. You can't dismiss miracles because they're an important element in the shlichus, in the mission of Moshe Rabbeinu. And as we said, that's the way God redressed Moshe's protest. He said, "They won't believe in me. They won't believe that God, why should they believe that God spoke to me?" Which again, you can deduce from that it is not correct, that it's not the will of God, and it's certainly not the position of Torah that people should just believe because of belief without proof. Because Moshe Rabbeinu raised the issue, v'heim lo yaminu, and God did not say that they have to believe in you, tell them that they have to have a miracle, that they have to have faith. There's no concept like that. God accepted it, good point. Even though Chazal criticized on a different level that Moshe spoke that way there for Nei Yisrael, but they're not Mamim. But that's a different idea, that's on the level of Chazal. Plain shot, Moshe's question was well taken, so to speak. Good point. And then God directs him, gives him three signs. Three signs. One is not enough for time. It's also interesting. See, because when you're establishing yourself on the basis of miracles, there's something lacking in one. Because that itself, I think, would give us a bit of a clue, an opening in terms of understanding the Rambam's position as to why Sinai is necessary. Miracles have a value, but you have to calculate the value of a miracle in terms of the effect. In terms of the effect, that is, a person in a certain situation will, provided that the miracle is authentic, convincing, will operate up to a certain point on the basis of the miracle. It does have an effect, but it doesn't produce the kind of lasting effect that's necessary. You see that the Jews didn't accept the Torah on the basis of miracles, but they did follow Moshe Rabbeinu. Bear in mind also that they were in a situation of enslavement, and they wanted to get out of that situation. And to accord him the proper authority and capability of being a leader, so the miracles had that effect. But when it comes to Torah, it's more than just that. It's more than just accepting the Torah or agreeing to follow the Torah. It's having a certain conviction, an absolute conviction that the Torah is necessary. And here is where the Rambam says that the miracle is not 100%. It does not satisfy the mind completely, because there's always room for doubt. Because I think that would explain why, even in the case of Moshe Rabbeinu, that God gave him through. Because that's also a factor. It shows you there's a certain doubt. If there was no doubt, if the miracle was absolutely convincing, so why would God have to give him more than one? It's just a waste. It's just duplication. But that, I think, is fitting with the Rambam's idea that a person always has questions. It's true. It's true that it's hard to explain. I can't explain how this could happen, how the staff could turn into a snake. But the fact that the person can't explain it, and the fact that it sort of leads you in a certain direction, is not absolutely convincing. Therefore, there's the miracle. More than you see with regard to Mitzrayim too. You had 10 miracles. The quantitative factor is an important element in the establishing the veracity of miracles, because each one in and of itself is true, but there's a certain element in the mind that maybe it's a coincidence, maybe, because it's an indirect phenomenon. You're making a certain deduction. You're filling in a certain blind spot, and of course when you fill it in, it makes sense to assume that what this person is saying is true, that it's from God. But you're not absolutely convinced, because you don't really see it yourself. The point being made that we see that the Egyptians quote-unquote duplicated some of the osos, some of the makos. Now, what does that mean? That they also have the power to change nature? No. And the Mepharshim learned that they were acting with magic. It was magic, which only creates an appearance, but it's not what Moshe was doing. Moshe was doing with a real Shina Hateva, a real change. Nevertheless, the fact that they could do so was sufficient to enable, to assist Pharaoh in denying the truth. Even though, if you compare the two, you would see the difference between what Moshe did and what the magicians did. Therefore, it shows you that a miracle lends itself to a certain deniability. A rational individual would come to a certain conclusion, but not everybody's rational. The way it's structured, it leaves a little bit of room for doubt. It's not absolutely convincing. To make it clear, again, getting back to the point that Moshe Rabbeinu came to the Jews with three signs, not just one, that indicates that the miracle in and of itself is not that convincing, that it doesn't leave any room for that, and the fact that you have a quantitative factor, the fact that it can be duplicated, and also in different realms. One is with regard to the staff, one is with regard to the skin, and one is with regard to water, and each one is like a different aspect of reality. That adds to the idea that there is some being who has this kind of control over the forces of nature. Bear in mind also that the main reason for following Moshe Rabbeinu was the person himself. There's an individual that says that the Navi, that you perfect the individual with tremendous wisdom, and not some charlatan. Who just, for whatever reason, we can't account, but somehow or other is connected to some kind of miraculous phenomenon. The miraculous phenomena go together with the character of the individual. And it's important that a person should have this in mind, not to be carried or swept off their feet by an appearance of something. No matter how convincing it may seem at the moment, let's see, you don't know. All the strange things happen. According to the Rambam, miracles were needed to establish the veracity of a Navi. And basically there's only one case where in the Torah, according to the Rambam, where a Navi establishes credentials to the miracles. The only case really is Moshe Rabbeinu, because the others did not engage in this kind of thing. The others never operated in miracles. The others operated through Chachma. They taught mankind about the falsity of Avodah Zarah, and they directed them towards the truth of Avodah Zarah and the correct way to serve God. But they did not resort to any kinds of supernatural phenomena to back up their case. That reinforces the point that the essence of Yadus does not maintain that people ought to be brought around to the truth because of the supernatural, by the power of the ideas, the logic, using their mind. That's the methodology that they use. And God performed miracles for them, but God did not perform miracles for them in that context. The only time, according to the Rambam, that miracles served this role was with Moshe Rabbeinu. Because after the Torah was given, there were many Nevi'im. But the reason why we have Nevi'im is because of a parish in the Torah, that's a mitzvah, that God, in his providential relationship with these people, will provide Nevi'im, will provide prophets, to guide the people, to chastise the people, to instruct them from time to time. And there's a mitzvah of the Torah to listen to the word of the Navi. That's Tzivei Hashem. And the Navi, but that has to be a legitimate, authentic Navi, and the manner in which he's established as a Navi is dictated by the Torah. Who is a legitimate Navi? Who's not a legitimate Navi? And according to the Rambam, he does not establish legitimacy through miracles. And the reason why, he just has to conform to the requirements of the Torah. He's defined as a Navi in accordance with the Torah. Once he has that definition, whatever he says in the name of Hashem, if it's a command, if God is commanding us at a certain point in history to do something, so then we're obligated to accept it as a Dvar Hashem, and upon pain of death. And anyone that rebels against the word of a Navi, according to the Rambam, we do not ask a prospective Navi. Somebody comes forth and claims that he has a Navua. We don't ask him to perform miracles. We do ask him, as part of the test of his credentials, to predict future events. He has to, the Rambam talks about this in his Akdama to the Pirush on the Chayim. And in other places, but that's the main place where he discusses it. And it has to be proven to be true in every detail. It's not a vague general thing, but it's got to be specific. It's got to be something which is in the future, which is really, there's no way that you can know. And it's got to be specific and correct and with regard to every detail. And if he is wrong in his predictions, or even in a particular, then he's defined as another sheker and he's put to death. This is a very, very serious type of phenomenon. Because you can't corrupt the whole institution of another. However, according to the Rambam, he's never asked, if he passes that test, he's not asked to perform a miracle. Because the reason why we believe him is not because of miracles. We believe him because there's a parsha of the Torah, the command is to follow the words of another. And if there was no such parsha, if there was no mitzvah, then we wouldn't accept anybody. We would just live in accordance with the Torah. And if somebody came along and claimed that he had special powers and special messages and did miracles, we would ignore him. Because there's no way we live in accordance with the Torah, and if the Torah did not contain a parsha about the Navi, so then we would say we're not interested in the book. We already have God's will. God has revealed his will to us through the Torah. People don't have that idea clearly, because you see, a lot of you here today, there's always cases of somebody having special powers and making predictions and all these different types of things. And there's this, when somebody says over some idea, some explanation in the name of some rebbe or whatever, and you challenge it, you question on logical grounds, and you enter a discussion, and then the other person can't defend it logically. So then there's that recourse, oh, you know, you're talking to this person is a Baal Mofes, you can find signs, and so on and so forth. You claim both through the individual's authority. As if to say that if that is the case, first of all, the answer is that if the person has to form any types of
miracles, which means supernatural phenomena, it should be done publicly. The fact that there's a rumor about it, I mean, there's no verification, renders it absolutely meaningless. Secondly, it wouldn't make any difference. If an individual were to come here today with some kind of an idea that we should do this or we should do that, or an explanation of Torah, some concept, and it didn't make sense, it was not logical, and any person who knew Torah would be able to refute it. And then this person would try to establish the credibility through performing some kinds of signs and wonders. It would not add one iota, but if something was false, it's false. And the fact that the person would do something which we couldn't explain, which would appear to be supernatural, would not in any way, shape, or form affect our behavior. For anybody to be influenced along those lines, that would be absolute key in the Torah. That's exactly what the Rav Maimon is saying. After Maimon Har Sinai, we cannot be affected, we cannot be influenced in any way, shape, or form by miracles or anything that would be appearing to us as miracles. Bear that in mind. We reject the Jesus, we reject Christianity, whatever the thing was. Whatever that claim was, whether Jesus actually held the idea of Christianity, or that was what they made it up later and projected it back on him, is irrelevant. If somebody were to come to us and say that we have to accept these ideas, the Christian ideas, and of course we reject it. And then that individual were to perform miracles, meaning changes in the order of things that we could not account for in a natural way. So what would you say? Oh well, if that's the case, we have to follow this. Well, we would be, this would be a test. But it is the possibility that such a thing would occur. The Rambam discusses it. I don't know that it ever happened in history. I know that false religions have developed in history. And you see this type of a way of thinking that affects the sitting down to get there among Jews. But you can't argue with him because he's known to have performed oaths or signs or miracles or whatever. He has special powers. But the Jews today don't reject that notion that they can attribute special powers to people. The guy, well, I've repeated that many times, there is no difference. But there is that sense that if a person has those powers, then somehow it gives credibility to his ideas. That's completely false, according to the argument. I don't know of a case in history where somebody tried to impose false ideas through the performance of miracles, other than that the rumor circulated that this person has the ability to. That's rumors. But in terms of really performing it in a public way, that would be the case that the Rambam talks about. If another Shekhar were to come and to try and dissuade us from keeping the Torah, and he would say, what should we do to you? We have the Torah from God. And he would say, no, this is God's will. And we would say, well, how do we know? Give us a sign. And he would perform the most devastatingly impressive miracle. Bigger than Kriya Shamsa, bigger than... The Rambam talks about this. And what would you do? We would absolutely reject it. Because we're not interested in miracles. We don't believe in the Torah because of miracles. So that we're going to now compare the miracles you perform to the miracles that Moshe performed, and then we'll decide who to listen to. That's exactly what the Ramban is saying. One of the reasons that the Torah is established on something which is beyond a miracle, an ordinary miracle, is to make it, to establish its veracity in an absolute way. Intellectually speaking, you know that it's the truth. If you know that it's the truth, then there can't be change. And therefore anybody that would come to you with something which contradicts the Torah has to be filled. Because you've seen with your own eyes in Torah. It would be the same situation would be when witnesses come and report something to you. You didn't see the event yourself. So then you're going to, you have to follow what they said, basically. You have no choice. Assuming you're credible, assuming you're going to have a lot of witnesses. But if you were there, if you were there and you witnessed the event itself, like the space shuttle, doesn't it?
Let's assume that that it really crashed. But they're trying to keep it a secret. So they're going to have television and but if they're trying to keep it a secret, so they're going to tell the people that it took off in the time and the way to space and whatever, and they'll work out the details later. That's the story. So all of the conspiracy now, all the witnesses that were there are going to make up that story. So now, if you weren't there, and all the people that report, that report, so then you'd have no choice. You have to go along with that. But look, you're there, and you start crashing into the ship, as you are. And now you have hundreds and thousands of witnesses are saying, like, is there any way that you would give any credence to what they're saying? Because the only time you give credence to the report of a witness is because you yourself do not have any knowledge, any independent knowledge of it, so then you have to go with a certain level of acceptance. And then you decide, well, are they credible? Should I believe them? Shouldn't I believe them? Whatever the case is. If it turns out that it's credible, then you'll accept it. But you'll never do so in a situation which is counter to what you yourself know to be true. Unless you just feel the power of your mind. What I'm saying is that our relationship to Torah, that the Torah comes to us from God, and it's the will of God that we keep the Torah, is based on our knowledge. It's based on our knowledge, and there's no way that anybody can convince us otherwise, no matter what miracle you perform. It would be if you were a sinner. If you were a sinner yourself, and you heard this from God, God commanded you to keep the Torah. So now you know firsthand that this is the will of God. So 5 years later, if an individual were to come to you and tell you that God communicated to him that you shouldn't keep the Torah, would you believe that person? Would you believe that person? You couldn't believe that person because your own knowledge told you that God wants you to keep the Torah. You were there. You heard the record from God. So you wouldn't believe it. Now, let's say he's doing both kinds of miracles. Would that increase your belief in what he's saying? And how would it increase your belief? What difference do you make if it's an impossibility? What this person is telling you is something that your own knowledge tells you is an impossibility. So therefore, you wouldn't believe it. You say it's impossible. What you're telling me is impossible. You say, well, what about the miracle? How is that? So I don't know how the miracle comes about. That's what he's saying. So then you would not be able to explain the miracle. The other Raman says, the only explanation would be God's presence. If indeed it is a miracle, which can't be explained in terms of any kind of human power, and would have to be subject to something beyond, so then God's presence is the test. And that's exactly what he's indicating. But it's impossible that what this person is saying is true, because I heard directly from God. That's in the next. Question is, what is it about Sinai that differentiates it from all the other miracles? Any possible miracle that a person could develop. And the surface of Sinai also seems to be miraculous times. The description of the mountain, that the mountain was consumed with a fire that went all the way up to the heavens, and then thick clouds and smoke was enveloped in thick clouds and smoke. All these things seems to be miraculous phenomena, the sound of the shofar, the tremendous sound. What seems to differentiate it is that above and beyond that, this was all the context for a voice from heaven. A voice from heaven is communication. There is a supreme being who actually now has manifested himself through the direction, through commanding us in mitzvot and ideas. A being of supreme intelligence who is directing, is addressing himself to us. That's the step beyond the miracle. Because the miracle is just a strange phenomenon which we can't explain. And it points in a certain direction, but it leaves a certain room for doubt because it doesn't answer the question. It's not direct. It's sort of the you know, you come to a place and you see what looks to be a design. You're not sure. Here's that one. Some kind of an excavation, or you know, like you come to this place in the middle of the forest, and it appears that there's a design, that there's an artist over here. But you can't explain that. You can't explain that. You're not absolutely convinced. But then you come into a, you discover a secret room, and you see this individual, and you see he's involved in painting, and you go, those paintings correspond exactly to what you saw. Now you see, you now see it in front of the rest. Beforehand, it could be this, it could be that. You're not really sure. It's not absolute. And that's the same idea we do. We have to go by the account in the Torah. This is what the Torah says. That is to say that the entire Jewish nation was gathered, and they heard a voice, and they were... We can't get into the issue of how do you know that this voice was from heaven? Maybe it was just a loud voice. We can't get into that issue because the entire nation, the group that was gathered there, was convinced that it came from God. They say that openly, they in fact appeal to Moses that they really couldn't take anymore. There's 2,000 of them. So that's something that you can't entertain any other possibility. You have to go by your sense of things. You can't deny. If you deny your own senses, then how do you know you saw anything? The important thing is that they saw something which convinced them that this was from heaven. That's the basis of the whole thing. What they witnessed then was that there is a being beyond this universe, and that being is a being of Chokhmah, and communicates with us, has complete control over the forces of nature. In other words, man was associating the cause or the source of the miraculous phenomena together with the being, with God. And in the other cases, you have miraculous phenomena. So therefore, you have to make the deduction of what the source is. These were phenomena that couldn't be duplicated by any person. If they could be duplicated, they have no value. These were phenomena that could not be duplicated. So now you're seeing phenomena that you can't account for. So either you could just negate it and say, well, I just can't explain it. Or you could say, oh, Moshe is saying that this is a demonstration of the power of the Supreme Being that brought the entire system into existence. But they didn't see that themselves. That's a deduction. And since it's a deduction, it leaves a certain amount of room for that, the deduction. But in this situation, you have the miraculous phenomena, and the cause addressing you at the same time, so now you see clearly that's where it comes from. Here's the phenomena, and here's the being who's responsible for the phenomena, talking to you and telling you that this is the reality of the situation. I am the Lord your God. I'm the one who took you out of Egypt. I'm the one who's responsible for all the phenomena that's supernatural, that's beyond nature. Now you're seeing the phenomena in conjunction with these thoughts. Who's communicating with you. That's why you're not making a deduction on it. Bear in mind that it's a very important detail. In all of the signs that Moshe performed, they all indicated, they all pointed in the direction of a supernatural being. So you could ask the question, why? Well, maybe Moshe is a powerful God. Why should I be the God? Now, Moshe has the ability to do it. That never came up. Paro, who rejected the message, didn't say, deify Moshe. But the mind rules that out. Any intelligent person has to rule out the idea that a human being can perform miracles. That's absolutely absurd. The reason being is because everything that exists that we can comprehend, that we're aware of, is a part of the system. It comes into being as a result. It's a product. Every animal is a product. Every individual is a product. So anything that exists only because of the system and is a product of the system only has the capability that can doubt it by virtue of what the system provides it with.
And therefore you wouldn't expect to find the board. That's why. I mean, the person looks for such an idea, he says it's absolutely insane. So where's this board going to get to? The board is not the author of its own abilities, it's just to the planet, it's human to being, because something else is on you. The absurdity is that when it comes to a man, which is no different, it comes to being as a byproduct of a system. So therefore he's been designed by something beyond himself, unless you want to maintain the eternity of the universe. But which of course, if that's the case, he certainly doesn't have any, there's no such thing as supernatural power. Therefore, it's absurd to say that that man can perform anything outside of the natural powers that he's endowed with. So man has intellectual powers, he has physical powers, whatever the case may be, but none of these things point to any capability of being above nature. You can't be above nature. By definition, you are coming from nature. You are nature. How can you have entertained such an idea of being above nature? So where is it that people come up with these ideas of people having supernatural powers? That's because of human egotism. It's this Superman phenomenon. Because people fantasize about such a thing. If there wasn't this human ego and this tremendous need to feel this domination over the system, then nobody would have such a crazy idea. So the only people that maintain such a thing, that a human being who's just a natural, is a product of a system and is endowed with natural abilities, can have anything other than natural abilities, is an absurdity. And that's why you reject the idea that Moshe is doing this thing. He's a human being for you. So therefore, it must be that how can it change? How can the natural processes be changed? This is the order of the universe. How can the order of the universe be changed? Well, if you maintain that the universe is eternal and the way things are the way they have to be because that's the way they are, that's the way they have to be. That's the eternity of the universe, then you can't have a change. But by definition, that's the reason why a thing is the way it is because it has to be there. But if you maintain that the universe has been created, that it has a creator, that the way it is, we find it now, is not because it has to be that way, because there is a being who wills that it should be this way, and he has absolute control over all of the different forces within the universe, and that being can bring about a change. That's what the whole point of the miracle is. The point of the miracle was to establish that the natural order of things, the way things are, and finally, is not because it has to be that way. It's because the Creator willed that it should be that way. And he has the ability to make a change. That's the concept. And that's what a miracle points to. Is how do you explain it? Now, you could say that no, that we're learning something new about the universe. You could say it's not a miracle, it's just something that has to occur. But we don't, until now, we've never seen it, but we don't know everything. We don't know how the universe is functioning, so how do we know that the universe is at a certain point in time that the waters are not going to stop? That's something which is the only argument you can make. There, the answer is that if that is the case, that if there's something which is completely unforeseen, completely unknown, but it's natural, it's not supernatural, then the question arises, how did most of them know exactly when it was taken? That's the role of another. But if that were the case, then Moshe Rabbeinu is no different than anybody else. And yet, how did he know that this event would occur in conjunction with the saving of the Jewish people, and then as soon as they came out, the waters would come back and destroy the Egyptians? They could see that it's functioning over here in accordance with a different set of causations, which it has to do with the will of the Supreme Being. But the main way that we know it is only through Moshe Rabbeinu. By the way, that's basically the rationalization. One of the rationalizations that probably is that these things happen once you've been the law being done, when they were democracy. When they wanted to rationalize and deny it, so they would say, well, so we don't know, once in 100 years these things happen. Yeah. But that was denial, because if that is the case, how could it be that it was precisely connected to a specific event with regard to the Jews, and that Moshe Rabbeinu predicted. The difference, a person can easily see the difference between magic, and a miracle. And it's not because you ask the magician and the magician will tell you the sleight of hand. It's simply that every magician, you can tell when magic, when there's a magic show, because there's a certain distance that you have to maintain. They never, you get a team of scientists, they're a team of scientists to examine any one of the illusions that are performed, or the best magic trick. A team of scientists know three actors. To see, to be behind the curtain, to you give them free access, let any illusionist or magician have a group of other magicians have completely free access. You cannot maintain any kind of control. Every magician maintains a certain type of control over the environment that he's in. Keeps the audience at a distance, and so therefore the curtain goes around, and as soon as it comes up, it's a line, and the girl is done. But to you, you can't. But there's a trick. So if you insisted on these conditions, then no magic could exist. They never would allow it. They never would allow it. So the same thing with Tara. Why did God give Moshe Rabbeinu a sign which could be duplicated? Well, you read the passage, you see, Balakayim. They did this with their secret devices and in a magical kind of a way to create a certain appearance. And then his snake swallowed their snake. So that if Paro really wanted to, if he called in the magician because of a scientific interest and establishing whether they could duplicate it, he would have discovered that it's his magic. But the reason why he spoke to the prophet is that he hardened his heart. Below Shalom, he hardened his heart. Why do you have to harden his heart? If he had refuted Moshe, by virtue of what his magicians had done, so why did he have to harden his heart? The answer is because he had to harden his heart, because if he would have been completely honest, he would have seen that what they were doing was not the same thing that Moshe Rabbeinu was doing. And I maintain that that's the case, that every time Moshe Rabbeinu did a sign, it was something that was in the open, that there was no secrecy to it, there was no magic associated with it, as opposed to all the magic that we know throughout history is exactly that magic. At the end of Shemitah Perakimim. Lefichach Amarad Hanavi V'yasa Otos Enosim Gedolim. He's saying after Sinai. After the foundation of our belief is not because of miracles, because we saw it on earth. And therefore if a Navi were to arise and perform signs and great signs and wonders, and he sought to refute the Nevuah of Moshe, he wouldn't listen to him. And we know of a certainty that those miracles, those signs are belot v'kishachim, that they're done with some type of a sorcery or magic. The teaching of Nevuah Moshe Rabbeinu ain't al pi osa, because the Nevuah Moshe Rabbeinu is not based on signs. To be shenarach oso zeh li oso zeh, so that we would weigh, we would compare these signs to those signs. Ela v'yaneinu re'inua, what we saw with our own eyes, would be as name Shamanua. And we heard it with our ears. Shamo to Shamahu, just like Moshe heard. Kolamaha Davagana, what is this analogy? Through the Aden Sheidu Adam of Davashiravinero. It's the same thing as two witnesses would testify to a person about something which he himself witnessed with his own eyes. She'eno Kimoshe Ra. And they would testify that it didn't happen the way he saw it. And no shamayelah, he didn't listen to them. El yodei abavadai shehenei besheka. He would know for a certainty that they are false witnesses. The tirach amar Torah, therefore the Torah says, shimba otziyam ofes, that if the sign and wonder actually does come true, this person does perform the sign and wonder, lo sishma, el divan av Yahu, that you shouldn't listen to the words of this nabi. That this person is coming at you with a sign and a wonder, to negate that which you saw with your own eyes. Behold, the inanimate of the mokes, and since we don't believe in the wonder, in the miracle, elam ben a mitzvah, because we've won a Moshe, but we only believe in another because of the mitzvah. Moshe commanded us, that's part of Torah, that in the future, if another should come, you should follow him. to the Rosh Hashanah Sefer and Iyur Rosh Hashanah. How can we operate on the basis of this sign and wonder to refute that which we know to be true because we've seen it with our own eyes? The Rambam in the Talmud to the Jewish on the Friday makes the same point. He's talking about a prophet who commands us to do something which is contrary to the Torah. We should not even attempt to verify his claim to prophecy. This is why he's speaking in the name of the Avodah Zarah, or that God wants us to worship a certain idol, or whatever, something like that. We should not even attempt to verify his claim to prophecy. And we should not ask him to perform a sign. Even if he did perform amazing signs and wonders as proof of his prophetic powers, he still must be silent. We should pay no attention to the signs, because the reason these miracles came about is, quote, that Hashem is testing you. There's a prophet in the Varan. Christ in the Varan, if you came in the Varan. So you have to give up a Navi, or call in Shalom, but nothing else for Osa Moshe. And he's talking about a Navi should arise and give you a sign, or a wonder. And the predict at a certain time, and then the sign would come true. The Moshe, the Shibu Barakha Lomar, concerning which he said to the Neocha Akhlei Elohim Akhairim, Ashallah Yadatam Ben Arjan. But his message was, had to deal with idolatry. Both Tishma El Dibre and Navi Ahur, do not listen. To this Navi Ahur, call away Machalan Hoki, Menasa Arashem Elokeh and Aspen. That God is testing you, Lord Das, Aishkan Ohavim, Ad Hashem Elokeh and Machalavachem, and Machalavachem. That this would be a test from God to see whether you love God with all of your heart and with all of your soul, which means to say whether the foundation of your amuna and the veracity of the Torah is absolute. The way the Rambam explains it in the Hakamas of the Pirush on the Shnayis, which seems to leave open the possibility that such a phenomenon could actually occur. And of course, all the other religions try to have reference to some miracle. If this one did or the other one did. And of course, they don't really have anything because they can't bring any proof. Because there's no case in history where anybody did a public miracle which convinced the entire people that what they were witnessing was a miracle. All the miraculous stories attributed to Jesus or Muhammad, whatever it is rumors. It was never publicly verified. Yeah, they didn't say it, they walked on water, but you don't have anybody testifying that they saw it. So this has never really occurred, but even if it was, the underlying premise somehow is that if they could convince you that he did these things, then you'd have to follow him exactly what it said. Even if it was confirmed that he did this, that he flew around the world and came back and landed on a seat, it would be meaningless, it would have no effect whatsoever. But then you've left the question of how can it be? If it would be something that you have to assume is a miracle, like you have to rule out magic. I believe that that's what the Torah says. That if, of course, first you would check and you try and get all the magicians together to show that it can't do. But even if you couldn't do that, and even if the magicians did not attribute it to any kind of magic, it would be meaningless, because we would say it's coming. So the idea that there could be something which we would have to view as miraculous phenomenon associated with the attempt of somebody to dissuade us from Torah is something that could arise in the framework of the text. I don't know of any case where it actually happened, but that's the Torah saying, and that's what the Rambam is saying. This is why the Torah was established on a foundation which is not miracle, which is direct, as direct as is possible for the human mind, for the human being, to come in contact with the source. A direct confrontation with God's Bible. That's what the idea is all about. Once that's the case, that your knowledge of Torah is direct, it's not based upon anything extraneous, so then you're in a situation now of someone who's heard from the commander himself, so to speak. And the other people are testifying that the commander gave different orders. Now, as I said, normally if you didn't hear from the commander, so you have no choice. You have to listen to those who claim to be witnesses. But when you heard the commander yourself, you were there when he issued the orders,
And he said, don't attract, so nobody can convince you otherwise.
And I want to make it clear that the objective of Mahmoud Hasinai is two specific objectives. Of course, they're connected with each other. And one is to reveal the existence of God. Not just the existence of God, but the fact that the Torah is from the third level, to affirm the divine source of the Torah. Now, something which is intricately connected to that is the phenomenon of Moshe Rabbeinu. That is to say that God did not reveal the entire Torah on Har Sinai. He just revealed a part of it, the Esaras HaGibra. And we have to go into it, we have to make a study of why, what's so unique about those 10 ideas, the 10 Gibras, which constitute more mitzvahs. These are the major foundations, major headings, whatever you want to say. It's an extremely significant portion of the Torah. It's contained in the Esaras HaGibra. But it's not the entire Torah, as you all know. So therefore, what was also essential was that the source of Torah is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but the Torah is going to be transmitted to us via certain individuals. First and foremost is Moshe Rabbeinu. So therefore the authenticity of Moshe Rabbeinu has to be established, because everything that's going to be revealed to us is going to come out from through Moshe Rabbeinu. So therefore the ultimate authenticity of the Nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu was also established at Sinai, and that is stated clearly in the pasuk. It's a very crucial pasuk. It says, "Nei anochi bo elecha bi'ahava hanan." This is the pasuk in which God tells Moshe the manner of the revelation. I'm going to come to you in the thickness of a cloud. Ba'avur yishma ha'am b'gavi yimach, in order that the people will hear when I speak to you. And also in you, also implies that it's not the only idea, but it's an integral component. Also in you will they believe forever. Now, there's a number of ideas over here, but the essential ones are the people will hear, the people will have first-hand knowledge which will come about through their senses, through the mechanism of their senses, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that the Creator addresses mankind. And that's the first idea. So therefore we know that there is a Creator, first and foremost, that there is a Creator. We know that the Creator is not removed, is not aloof from the creation. Well, many names for the Creator are removed, that God is aware of what goes on in the universe, that it's got to, so to speak, concerned about how people should live their lives, and perhaps more significantly, maybe the idea of prophecy, that God communicates in a manner which is knowable to us. Those are some of the ideas. That's Torah. Torah is the natural life. But there's another significant aspect, and that is how did God transmit his ideas to us? That's the mechanism of the ruler, the ruler, and not everybody's a number. So this is to authenticate the ruler of Moshe Rabbeinu, and it's not only with regard to the written law, it's to authenticate Moshe Rabbeinu with regard to everything and every aspect of the revelation, which of course includes the oral law as well. And the olam means not just Moshe, but all those who come after Moshe. That Moshe is going to establish the system, the Balei HaMasorot, those who are authorized to transmit the Masorot. The system that Moshe Rabbeinu establishes, because you have to have such a system. You see why these two are necessary, and one idea follows from the other. If you accept the fact that the written law, so to speak, the source of the Torah, is from God, then you're obligated to accept the authenticity of the so-called Torah of the oral law, because it's impossible to decipher. It's impossible to understand the meaning of the Torah of the Prophet without recourse to the system of interpretation. All of the ideas, all the explanations, what this stands for, what this means, or what is the chart on the Okoligatha, what is the stone. None of the laws in the Torah are spelled out with any type of specificity. There's no way that you can possibly figure out the will of a Kaddish Rabbi. You can't figure out the system. You can never figure out the mitzvah. So it is clear that one idea follows from another. That if we assume, if we're convinced that at Sinai God was communicating to the Jewish people, of course, and ultimately to mankind, the system by which he wants people to live, and it's something which is capable of being understood and implemented, then there's got to be a body of interpretation, a correct body of interpretation, because the Torah of itself, by itself, in and of itself, is impossible to figure out. It's written in such a way that nobody can possibly figure out, even in a general sense, what it's referring to. It's not a self-contained unit, as opposed to sometimes an author writes a book. Some people write more specifically, some people write more clearly, some people write less clearly, but if a person has any clarity whatsoever, you can more or less can figure out what he's saying. And you can say, well, I've got the general idea, I don't know exactly every aspect, but I got 80%. That's true, you read an editorial in the paper. At least you know what the person is saying, you may not agree with the person. But you read the Torah, and in that way too, that all of the various texts, whether they're in Judaism or they're outside of Judaism, Christian texts, that limit themselves, essentially they're all united in one thing, the rejection of the Torah of the rejection of the oral law. If you limit yourself just to the Torah of the Prophet, just to the written law, then there's, virtually an infinite amount of possibilities. You can screw it anyway you want. And you have absolutely no way of knowing what you're talking about, whether what you're saying has any validity whatsoever. So you can put the law, and therefore there's no objective has been achieved. The objective that the God is communicating is working mankind has not been achieved clearly solely through the means of the law. So that's why you have to assume that at the same time, God communicated the proper way to understand. And that, of course, we have. But you go back from generation to generation, those very same sources that communicated the written law to us have communicated the oral law to us. I've gone a little bit further than the question. The question primarily was addressed to the idea of Moshe Rabbeinu, that the ultimate validation of the Nebuah of Moshe Rabbeinu. And more than that Moshe Rabbeinu is the selected instrument. Not necessarily just in this case or in the other case. Not necessarily when we let the two guys in Christ. But that in all cases, that Moshe Rabbeinu has been designated by the Baruch to be the spokesman. This is what God tells Moshe Rabbeinu to pray. That both Tiachar to Om and Israel, Tavdun as well as Mahar, how is that? Alright, now the question is that if that is the case, that it was the will of God that the people should have direct knowledge of the fact that the Torah comes from God and that Moshe is designated the spokesman. So, if that is the case, so what about all the future generations? Because I'm going to argue that you can say that I'm good that's the generation that actually witnessed it. And many people, if they had reason there, had even witnessed such a thing, as described by the Torah. Then, of course, we would draw the proper conclusion. This would remove all doubts from our hearts. And our belief would be complete. Now, if that is the will of God, that our belief in the Torah should be based upon this type of a knowledge, so what about all future generations? What is the basis for the belief of the generations that were not present at Sinai? That's the question. Now, in the divine, the Torah commands us not to forget what we saw. that this event was orchestrated and brought about in such a way that it would be not limited, it wouldn't be limited just to those particular people that saw it, but it would provide the basis for all mankind throughout all of history to be able to ascertain that the event occurred. This idea is mentioned in the Gemara. And that makes a lot of sense. But if you say that God's return is fortunate for that particular generation, but what good would it do if it was limited just to that generation? And the Pasuk itself says, "V'gam b'chol yamim yom yolam," that they'll believe in you la'olam. So therefore, it's necessary to assume that God did it in such a way that we would have knowledge of it, that all future generations would be able to know that this event actually occurred. And once they know that this event actually occurred, so then they'd be in the same position as those who actually witnessed it. They would be in that position through their knowledge. Now this idea is stated in Devarim. Okay, let's take a look at Devarim. Look at Devarim, Perek Daled, Tes. After it mentions that God is our Yisrach Maskam, Yisrach Maskam, this is your Chachma, your discernment, in the eyes of the nation, they'll hear these statutes, they'll hear about these laws, and they'll say, Rak al Chacham and Avon, and then it's like that. Then you get a test, Rak Yishana Lacha, to guard yourself, Yishmor Nafsh Kamar, and guard your soul very much, and Kishkach of the Dvarim, Asher Ro Einecha. Lest you forget the matters that your eyes saw, when you're Suru Mubavcha, or lest you remove them, you allow them to be removed from your heart. You lose touch. It's more than just forgetting. It's losing touch with the ideas that lead you to this conclusion. You have to teach them to your children, and your children's children. The day that you stood before the Lord your God in Torah, then Morah just sent a line, and God said to me, Hakel li yasa ha'am. Gather unto me the people, Vashmiyeh nechtavara. And I'll let them hear my words, that they only learn, that they should learn the Yira Osu, Kalayamim. And so forth. Then it goes on to describe the event. And your days, and God spoke to you, Mitzotha Eish, from the midst of the fire. Then he told you the covenant and so forth. One second. The idea that the Jews are obligated to study this aspect of history, and that if you study history properly, you will be able to establish beyond a doubt that this event actually occurred, is mentioned over here in the book. These are the prisons. Take a look at Dalad Lama Bay. Tisha Alma Yaman Rishonim. Ask, inquire about the early days, the beginning. That's a reference to studying the history. Asha Hayu Lefanecha, the days that existed before you came into being, studying history. Yimunayom Asha Baro Otim Adam Alarot, go back all the way to from the very beginning of time. We're going to say Asha Mayim, that's Say Asha Mayim, from one end of the heavens to the other end. So, check the history of the entire world and see whether this phenomenon ever occurred. Haniya, Hagavar Agar Lazar, has this great thing ever occurred? Oh, Hanishma Kamal, or has anything been heard like it? So, compare what we're studying over here and see whether anything of a similar nature ever occurred in the result. Hashama Am Kol Elokim, here's the key thing. Has a nation ever heard the voice of God, Megdaber Mitocha Eish, speaking from the midst of the fire? The nation ever study history of a nation and see whether you have such a phenomenon, whether such an event exists in the history of any other nation. Oh, Anisa Elokim Lavar Lakakakor Joy Mikhail Gai.
or whether the this is a reference to the Tzias Mishraim. But this concludes on Lamed Hey, Atah HaReisa Ladah. You have seen to know Ki Hashem Hu Elokim Ein HaMuvada. This is saying that the foundation of our relationship with our Baruch Hu is based upon that, based upon knowledge. You have been shown. You have been shown to know. You do have been enabled to have a visual experience which will give you the appropriate type of idea, of knowledge. And then you should know this day and incorporate it into your heart that Hashem who Elohim, Hashemayim now, the Allah is talking, they know. As a result of everything that occurred to the Jewish people, the conclusion, the result of this is that we are obligated not to have some kind of a faith as the world understands. This is a tremendous mistake. But many Jews make this mistake because of assimilation. And because every religion is based upon this thing called faith, which means, for all intents and purposes, that it's something you just believe in. There's no way you can prove it. There's no way you can know whether it occurred or not. It's faith. So, and that's elevated to a high level. That's considered, a person of faith is considered to be a very exalted level, because even though he has no knowledge, he put his faith in it. Which really, from a rational standpoint, to the contrary, makes no sense at all. We extol, if you hold that the essence of a person is really the Tzelem Elokim, the divine element, the ability to think, to use chachma, to reason, so then that would be a serious criticism that in an area which is very vital, in any area, a person abandons wisdom and just follows emotion to guide him, that person would be lacking in terms of rationality to criticize. Certainly in the most significant of all areas, where his whole way of life is anchored in his religious beliefs, and this is something which he abandoned reason and follows a certain emotion that propels him. Or he follows a system that he was raised in, because he was raised that way. And he can't free his mind from that type of pressure to be able to think intelligently in that way, on his subject. Just been digesting a little bit over here that people have a tremendous resistance towards the idea that the fundamentals of Yahadus can be established through verification. I hesitate to use the word proof only because proof has certain connotations, so that then people with a lot of resistance will try and think criteria what constitutes a proof in accordance with science and what's acceptable as a proof. So I just want to avoid that whole hassle, so to speak. Remember, the point over here is that in accordance with the way the entire world functions, in accordance with the criteria by which we establish that certain things took place in history, and no intelligent person would question them. If we could establish what the criteria are by which people will accept things, people are convinced that certain things occurred in terms of history, so what we're saying is that this event, the event of Torah and Sinai, that God revealed Torah to the Jewish people, is not something which we are expected to just believe in. But if this is what the Torah itself is saying, if we study the matter from the perspective of how we establish things in history, you'll be able to see that this is as firm, that this is as firm and as clear and convincing as any other thing that we accept to be true in history, to the extent that, well, many things, we care, everybody agrees with specific things as historical knowledge. Historical knowledge essentially means, can we have knowledge about things that occurred that we ourselves didn't witness, the things that occurred outside of our own self-perception. That's really what the idea of history is. We weren't there. There's nobody living that witnessed the Revolutionary War. There's nobody that was around at the Civil War. There's nobody that has personal knowledge that George Washington was the first president. And many, many other things, and one wants to start to think about it. Yet, I don't think any of the same person questions that these things actually occur. This is not a matter of faith. I don't think the person says, well, I have faith that there was a revolutionary war. Essentially, all of the history that you've been taught. And I'm not talking about the interpretation. With regard to the fundamental facts of history, these are things that every intelligent person accepts as true on the basis of knowledge. He may not understand why. But that's what we want to really go into. That's the basis of the inquiry. What are the criteria by which we accept certain things as being indisputable? There's no question in our minds, we accept them to be true. From that angle, this is the question as to whether Sinai occurred, as it is described in the Torah, is really a question, did a certain event occur in history at a certain point? It's a question of history. Another aside, the word emuna, the word emuna does not mean faith, as most people take it to mean. For example, we use the word amen. In your book, you say amen. And what does it mean, amen? That you affirm, that you ascertain, that you give your concurrence to something. The word lahamin, for example, is said by Yosef uses this word when he's incarcerating his brother. And he tells them to go home and bring back the other brother. V'ayamin divreichem ha'emesetchem. We will ascertain. In other words, we'll speak to the younger brother, we'll interrogate him, and we'll make an investigation to see whether his story confirms your story. V'ayamin divreichem. So really, it means something which is ascertained and which is clear to you. It doesn't mean that you just believe in something without any basis in knowledge. It's something which is affirmed, which is clear. Yeah. Clear does not endorse blind faith. To the contrary, it's prohibited. To the contrary, the Ramban says it's a mitzvah. You're under the obligation of the mitzvah to know. To know why it is that we base our lives on the Torah. Why we maintain that the Torah is from God. That's something that we have to have through the idea, through knowledge. And if you don't accept that, then first of all, why did God orchestrate it that way? I assume you believe that the Torah is true, or you have faith that the Torah is true, and then the Torah says that God appeared before the entire people in order that they should know. Then it says over there in that very context, V'gam l'cha ya'aminu, and also in you they will believe. What do you mean? So you see, it's not talking, the ya'aminu is not talking about a blind faith, because it's precisely through this knowledge. Through this knowledge, through what they've observed, that they will come to the ya'aminu b'cha. So ya'aminu means that it will be clear to their minds, that they'll think it through, and they'll have the evidence that's necessary to arrive at a conclusion. That's emunah. Now they're convinced, they have a conviction. A better word for emunah is conviction. That's a much, much better word. But a person is obligated to have a conviction. And this conviction, in terms of the fundamentals, should be based upon that part of the mind which operates with intelligence, with wisdom, with chokmah. So as I said, with regard to other things in history that are vital, you can base your life on. You don't do so because you have a certain type of a blind faith. You're operating with a certain chain of ideas which make it very compelling. The problem, however, is, as I said, that we don't question. Nobody seriously questions that World War I took place. Most of the major events, and I'm talking just on a factual basis, there's a lot of controversy in history with regard to interpretation. That's something else. Because when you're talking about interpretations, you're not talking about clearly demonstrable facts. And then there's too many people can speculate all they want. That's something else. But with regard to there's thousands and thousands of books on World War I, World War II, there's millions of books. Or from different perspectives and so forth. But every one of these books all are agreed on the basic fact that World War II took place, and the basis of World War II. Who fought against who? Who won the war? When did the war begin? And so on and so forth. The basic facts of history. Nobody questions that. Having said that, we're going to try and proceed to apply the standards by which we determine that something occurred in history. We're going to try and establish what the criteria are. And once we establish what the criteria are, then we'll see whether they can be applied to what the Torah describes, to the event that's described in the Torah. That is, that an entire nation was gathered, and they saw the tremendous fire, and they heard his voice, and that this nation was absolutely convinced that the Creator was communicating with us. Now, in order to approach this, the question is, what is the criteria by which we accept things as being true in history? Historical knowledge. Now, in order to facilitate an understanding of that, we can really put the question in a different way. Because there are two different types of knowledge that we live with. Two different ways that we have of ascertaining things. One is direct, first-hand knowledge, and the other is second-hand knowledge. So, what do we mean by first-hand knowledge? Yeah, something which you yourself believe. You witnessed a fire, so you have first-hand knowledge of that fire. Or you perform an experiment, so you know that you know a certain procedure. Now, let's ask ourselves, let's get a certain perspective. In terms of most of the knowledge that you live by, that you base your life upon, what percentage of it would you say is first-hand knowledge, and what percentage would you say is second-hand knowledge? Which is the greater? Yeah, the truth of the matter is, if you start to think about it this way, you'll see that there's very few things that you really know in the first-hand way. For example, who's the President of the United States? Of course, George Bush. But if I ask you, how do you know? Does anybody here have knowledge, first-hand knowledge? The answer is, you saw it on television? What do you know from a first-hand perspective? You haven't seen anything first-hand. You pictures on television, that's just television. How do you know that what you see is true? You see a picture of an individual in a White House at a podium and so forth, how do you know that that's true? That's not first-hand knowledge. Because you're trusting somebody else. Someone else has determined, has set up the props, has created this picture. You're basically following somebody else. How do you know that it's not an imposter? And today, we all have first-hand knowledge about camcorders. Everybody knows that this is a thing. Everybody knows that they can dress an individual up. And everybody right here, we could make a film. I could be posing as president. You can duplicate the podium, President of the United States, President Mann, and so forth, and broadcast to the whole nation. You can all do that. Everybody can turn on their television and hear a press conference from President Mann. If you think about it, you'll realize that there's very, very few things in your life that you have any real first-hand knowledge about. You go to a doctor, you put yourself in his hands, you get on an operating table, how do you know? Yeah, how do you know that he's a doctor? And how do you know when you buy a product that it doesn't have poison in it? I would say, the more you think about it, there's very few things that you know in that way that you've witnessed personally. And you have no, that's basically the... See, that has nothing to do whether it happens happening now or whether it's happening in the past. That's what history is all about. History is essentially how do we ascertain what is true in terms of second-hand knowledge. Because when we're talking about history, we're talking about those things that happened in the past. We're talking about those things that we ourselves did not witness. So now the question is, and this is something which I'm not saying that it's irrational for people. It's rational for people to be clear, you know, to have no doubt that George Bush is the president. I'm not suggesting that that we should start wondering, or that the United States is a superpower, or that the World War II occurred, and so forth. However, these things, people function in an instinctive kind of a way with regard to these things. We have to really analyze it. So we ask the person, how do you know the World War II took place? So say, well, are you crazy? I mean, he's not going to... What's wrong with you? Of course you know it took place. But that's different than actually isolating what the factors are and making a formula out of it. Because in order to apply it to Sina, you have to have a formula. If you knew what the formula was, what is the formula by which an intelligent individual is bound to accept something as being true, then we could apply it to the phenomena. So let's ask ourselves the question. In terms of secondhand knowledge, what are the factors which determine whether we should accept somebody's report as being true or not being true? Some of the factors quickly. Whenever we receive a report from someone else as to something which we did not witness, so you have to make a decision. Should you accept it as true or not? So basically, we accept it as true if we can eliminate all of the factors of distortion, of falsehood. We have to understand what would cause a certain report to be untrustworthy, to be lacking in trustworthiness. If we can eliminate, if we can determine what those factors are, then when somebody gives us a report, so we want to ascertain whether it actually is true or whether it's not true. So essentially what you're doing is you're going to test it. Now a report from another individual would be suspect because of two possible factors. What are the two possible factors?
Either
he's lying, that's what we put, either he's lying, or he's not lying. But just because he's not lying doesn't, it could still be wrong because he could be making a mistake. So let's see, how do we proceed from there to try and eliminate those factors? For example, let's assume that he's not, We know that he's not lying. He's not a liar. So now we've eliminated one of the factors that would cause us to question. But the question is, maybe he's making a mistake. How do you eliminate the factor of mistake?
Something very simple.
Yeah. If the thing in question is something which is within the range of his knowledge and understanding. And that the more complex the thing is, the more questionable does he really understand. Perhaps he's making a mistake. If he's talking about something in abstract physics or whatever the case may be, of course, it depends who the person is, his level of knowledge. But the simpler the thing is, for example, we're taking an ordinary individual of normal intelligence, and he reports, he comes from town in the south, let's say, or something, and he reports to the snow, which is unusual. So now let's say you've eliminated the possibility to the satisfaction of your mind that he's lying. So he has no reason to lie. So then the question would be, only one that he's making a mistake. But what would the answer be? That any normal intelligent person can determine if it's lying. It's not something that requires any expertise. So if that's the kind of thing, if that's the kind of thing that we're talking about, so then you'd accept it as being true. If the kind of thing he's reporting about is something more complex, and it's not obvious to everyone, so then you can have more doubts about it. So therefore, the way to eliminate the factor of mistake is essentially through if the phenomenon in question are simply, clearly, easily within the range of the of this person's knowledge, the one who's reporting it, so then you eliminate the possibility of mistake. Now the question is, how do you eliminate the possibility of lying? blood. So then the answer is that generally speaking, if you're dealing with it with a particular individual, so then it's a question of motivation. If the person has any motivation, so then it's suspicious. If the person has no motivation whatsoever, so then you can eliminate the possibility of lying. Alright? Now, there's another way in which you can eliminate the possibility of lying. And see, here again, you'll see, people are going to argue and say, well, it's always possible. So when I use the word possibility, I mean really the probability. Because we're talking about establishing a proof over here. We're talking about knowing something. I'm talking, even when you know something, when you're convinced that it's true, there's nothing that you're convinced about that's true that you couldn't say it's impossible. You couldn't say such a thing. People based on they trust a certain individual. They trust them with their health. They trust them with their money. Then they trust their life. And it's based upon solid evidence of performance and all of that. And then you're saying, I'm rationally convinced. It's impossible that this person would cheat on me. But technically speaking, you can't say it's impossible. It's possible. It's possible that they have been. And anything is possible. When I'm saying impossible, I mean in terms of the subjective demand that a rational person would make. And that's rationality. That's what I mean. You see, what's the problem that people sometimes raise against this? Well, it's always possible to say something else. It's always possible to say, if this happens, I don't mean that. I'm talking in terms, when I say that such a thing is impossible, it means to the satisfaction of the human requirements that an intelligent person does not, you can't, no, nobody has that capability of eliminating that idea. I mean, you can always say it's possible, but we don't operate that way. In the same way that halakha based itself on a certain chazaka, that something was left in place and it's kosher and there's a system and so on and so forth, it's always possible that somebody came in and said, we moved the kosher food and snuck in other things and it looks identical. But it's possible. You always say it's possible. But you don't regard that as a valid possibility in terms of making the determination. That's what I'm trying to say. So there is another way, and what the other way is that if something is confirmed by masses of people, by large groups of people, they all tell the same story. For example, if you were standing outside of Shea Stadium, and there was a game on, you were inside, and somebody came out and told you that during the game, in the game, a lion jumped out of the stands and ran across the field and jumped up and caught the ball, and then it went into the dugout, something like that. So now, from the standpoint of sense perception, you would say it's the test, because that's something anybody could see. You could see a lie, you could see everything the person described. But then you'd be suspect, because it sounds strange, and maybe he wants attention, he's making up a story. Now let's say that you had 60,000 people. So what you do is, you interview every person that was there. And every person tells you the exact same story. So now, what would you do? Would you still be skeptical? Or you would say, well, first of all, the person is telling you that it's possible it's a school of strength. But why would you then believe it? The reason why you would believe it is because you'd be faced by this question. Either the event occurred or it didn't occur. Now, if the event occurred, well, that's what you've already done. But if it didn't occur, how did you who and how were you able to get everybody that was there to affirm the story, and there's no dissenting opinion, to convince people to tell the story, and they tell the story, don't change after a few minutes. This story is the story that they tell to their children, and all the people that were there, there's not one dissenting opinion. How do you achieve a thing like that? So either you believe in mass conspiracies, Now, if you believe in mass conspiracy, so I want you to understand that you don't know anything. That there's no way of knowing anything, because maybe the fact that, how do we know that there was a revolutionary war? Well, you don't know. Let's just say, well, the history. Yeah, but so what? Maybe somebody wrote a history book. 2 years ago, somebody, how do you know that these history books are true? People can write, there's many books that are false, the fact that it's in a book. The way you know it is because this history book has been accepted by wherever you go throughout America, that's the history that's being taught, that this history has been accepted by this people as a valid, legitimate account of what actually occurred. So that means you have to ask yourself this question, well, did it occur or didn't it occur? If it did not occur, then how did you convince an entire nation to accept as the foundation of their history something which never happened? That goes contrary to all of our experience, that people are not going to do that. Now, no people are going to agree to accept something, to accept as their history. Not in terms of teaching to their children that this is what we experienced, something which in point of fact they never did. Now, I maintain that that's the foundation, but that is an impossibility. It's impossible, and that's what it means to tell that it's never occurred. Other religions, well, whatever religion, millions and millions of believers, bear in mind that no other religion do you have a situation where a group of people are saying that they personally were there and witnessed the phenomenon. There was never a case of a mass revelation. All of the Christians accepted Christianity because they had the few guys, the apostles, whatever it was, and they convince people that this occurred in a different place. But the Christians themselves don't testify that they themselves witnessed it. All they testify is that they believe what these people told them. That's something else. The fact that people believe something, the fact that people have faith in something, is absolutely no proof to the contrary. It doesn't give any authenticity. It's no proof that it occurred, because in the realm of belief, people are the craziest beings. But just because millions, and see, when it comes to ideas, or when it comes to beliefs that people have, numbers is absolutely meaningless. To the contrary, the more people believe in something, the more suspicious it should be, because obviously, because most people don't use their mind. What we're saying, the validity of Torah and Sinai is the testimony that they witnessed it. Now, if you take this, and I just want to say one more thing. Throughout history, there's been many charlatans, many false religious leaders, and even political leaders, that wanted to have the allegiance of the people. There were kings that ruled by divine right, that they claimed to have divine right. There were religious leaders. There was Hitler, Yamashimo. All of these individuals tried to convince mankind that they were acting with some kind of a higher dispensation. But did they ever appeal to the people and say, you have to follow me because you were there when God came down and commanded us to go on this course? How come there's not one religious leader in history that ever did such a thing, or even tried to do such a thing? And even today, people that claim that they have powers, it's all in secret. Let somebody come and make a claim that we all witnessed, we were there. And we witnessed when God came down and said to follow me. Now, why wouldn't somebody make a report to that? That would be a tremendously powerful tool. The answer is because people will reject it absolutely. And the people can be manipulated, and people can be maneuvered into believing, but you cannot get people, especially large groups of people, to affirm that they witnessed an event which in point of fact never occurred. That I maintain is an impossibility. And it would be virtually impossible to convince even a small group like this that you were here today and you saw the tables being lifted and all kinds of miraculous phenomena come. You couldn't be, even a small group couldn't be convinced. But certainly a large group of hundreds of thousands of people would be convinced that they, that it was, now apply this to Thermosia. Hundreds of thousands of people are testifying that this is their history. That they were gathered, and this site that we've described, the fires, the thick cloud, the sound of the shofar, and a voice from God proclaiming the Ten Commandments and establishing Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, how is it possible that this became the basis of the history of the Jewish people? This was clearly accepted by the Jewish people, and they transmitted it from generation to generation. Now, you have two possibilities. Either it occurred, or it did not occur. If it didn't occur, how did anybody, and we have to say that at a certain point in time, somebody managed to get these people to accept this book, which gives a completely different history of their origins and their religion that's completely alien to them. Isn't it natural that these people would reject it and say, it's not true, it's not our history? It would be like somebody were to come to America today and convince that this is not, there was never a Revolutionary War, but George Washington is a fiction, a completely different version of history. So the American people would absolutely reject it. So therefore, the fact that throughout Jewish history there was never ever a movement that arose and said, this is not true. We don't have this history. We were never at Har Sinai and all of that. You see in the rest of the Torah that whatever Moshe commands the Jews, there's rebellion against Moshe, there's disagreement, there's resistance, there's a lot of rebellion from the Torah, but never once do they say that it's not true, there was no Sinai. No one ever questioned that. So what we're saying over here is that by virtue of the fact that this story is found in the Torah. So of course the question is, how do you know that it's true? It's a book. The fact that it's recorded in the Torah doesn't make it true, because the question is, how do I know the Torah is true? The answer would be that this entire nation accepted it as a valid account of their history. Place it on the same level as any other valid account of any other nation's history. So either you accept history or you don't. I'll tell you something else. It's interesting to note, you see another confirmation that the major religions of the world did not have any separate, their whole foundation, their whole, they didn't have any basis in terms of their own personal origin. Any miracle, everything goes, so why does everything start with the so-called Old Testament? Why didn't the Christians start completely separately? Why? And why did Islam, why didn't it start? Every Islam also goes back to everybody affirming the revelation of Sinai. None of them want to say that there's changes or whatever, there's distortions. But in terms of origin, every religion of the world that's based upon revelation, any religion that's based upon revelation goes back to the so-called Old Testament. Why? Because it's impossible to start from scratch. We are the only ones that have this phenomenon of a system which is established upon a public revelation which is uncontested. Which ask, again, how did it happen? Why couldn't another religion establish, if that is something which can be fabricated, if you can convince people to create a history that didn't happen. And it's not just based upon a relatively indifferent event, it's a very significant event, because if it's something which burdens you, so to speak, with commandments and obligations and so forth, like the whole history of the Jewish people. So there'd be a tremendous resistance to accepting it. As I said, I couldn't convince you to say that you saw something which is even irrelevant. Because you're not going to accept something that you didn't see. As a lie. It's a lie. But something which would be counter to your natural desires, why would you affirm something? Which means that you're bound by God and there's a covenant and you're going to have all kinds of obligations and so on and so forth. You see that in order to establish such a thing is an impossibility. It is impossible for anyone to establish a religion with a significant group of people. I'm not talking about two people. With a significant group of people that would be in the thousands, hundreds of thousands, which would be based upon the fact that these people testify, and they testify not just in that generation, but by passing down to their children this history. They're passing that we were there in the sense that this is the history that we passed down generation to generation to generation. It has to be passed down generation to generation, because if it wasn't, then at a certain point in history somebody would be trying to change the history. Then you have different versions. Then you'd have people, the ones that wouldn't accept the new version, saying it's a phony. That at a certain point in history, they tried to change our history, and we rejected it. Therefore, it's never been done. And that's what the Pasuk in Devarim means when it says, She'al no liyam rishon, study history. This is what you're supposed to study. The entire world. Go first the entire world. Go through all of history. Did such a thing ever happen? It never happened because it can't happen because it's an impossibility. So essentially what takes place with regard to the Jewish people, the establishment of a system, the establishment of a nation, which passes on from generation to generation a history which is based upon this event, is something which would be impossible to predict. It's impossible to fabricate. That's why when God revealed the Torah to us, He did it in a manner which would prove beyond any doubt to an intelligent person. Now, of course, then there's all kinds of when people hear this and resistance that. Then they say, well, maybe it was Martians. All that stuff is absurd. If you know, Project Martians, it's the same thing. Maybe Martians convinced the people that George Washington, or maybe that there was a British Boston Tea Party and so forth. All that is absurd. It was done, you can understand the beauty of what's taking place over here, the so-called orchestration. It was the will of God to set it up in a way which makes it true beyond any shadow of a doubt. There's not even any room for faith over here. This is knowledge. The mind is absolutely convinced that it must be the case because it is established on the firm principles by which we determine that things that we didn't witness, secondhand knowledge, we accept this, basically this principle of universality. The idea of eliminating a mass conspiracy. That's why you get on an airplane. And you have no way directly of knowing whether it can fly, what condition it's in. But you're relying on many, many different people could not be fooled, could not be deceived. And if there was a deception, you hear about it. People would come running up and say, there's no engine in there on this plane. There's a whole system. Anytime a person, somebody would come out and make certain claims, immediately people investigate the claim. So it's impossible to establish something which is affirmed by masses of people, but in point of fact it's a fabrication. And as I said, if you accept that possibility, then you can't base anything, you can't live your life. And the only thing you could live by would be first-hand knowledge, which is very, very limited. It doesn't give you much room. So clearly, and nobody regards themselves as being irrational. To the contrary, it would be irrational to reject. The person that says, look, since I don't know the pilot, since I don't know the doctor and so forth, I'm just going to live in a cave somewhere. I'm just moving myself to first-hand experiences. That person would be very cool. Does rationality dictate that the system works? You see that it works. There's a system here. And these are the basics of the system. So when you apply the rules by which we establish that it is rational to accept historical phenomena, World War II, everybody that was there, the entire world, accepts the fact that it was World War II. Interpretations, who caused it, so forth, that's a matter of interpretation. That's not simple fact. The Six-Day War. Everyone accepts that the event occurred. The war was maybe as a conspiracy. How do you know that it happens? It's possible. The answer is, we regard that as being a practical impossibility. So those are the essential criteria. And if a person applies them to Torah and Sinai, then you come to the conclusion that it is something which would be absolutely impossible, never has been done, never will be done, and that's why all the religions, as I said, harken back to our revelation, because that's the only one that is accepted. That is the only case where a nation accepted the truth of a religious system based upon testimony that they witnessed, a public revelation. The idea is that what the purpose of the Ma'amad Har Sinai, or the so-called revelation is spelled out in greater detail in the Gemara. But in the Gemara, Moshe Rabbeinu is reviewing certain aspects of Torah from the standpoint of giving the Jews the proper Musar, and the Tochacha, and the impact that it should have in terms of their life. He's presenting it more from the philosophical significance. So therefore, there are more details that are presented to us in the Torah which are omitted in Shemot. But in Shemot, it's just describing the event. But the fact that this event is significant and is to serve as the foundation is mentioned in the Pasuk in Shemot, where it says, when God tells him the reason. Man of Hubara, the Avahana, Avah Yishma, Ambedavi, the Dam Machaya, Mimuyala. So that's very terse, but in one pasuk, the objective of the revelation is established. And that is to say that an entire nation shall be witnessed. And that is the key. Just briefly review the major points. The uniqueness of the Torah and the manner by which we know that it came about, that the origin of the Torah is in an event in which the Creator of the universe manifests himself and reveals the Aseret HaDibros and the basics of the system that he wants people to live by, is by virtue of the fact that he created witnesses. An entire nation became witnesses to the event, thereby rendering it something which cannot be challenged, which any rational person who understands what the factors are that determine whether a person should accept something as being true. Any person that's operating with certain principles that determine what he embraces in terms of conviction would have to accept it. A way of looking at it is, if a person were to ask the question, well, how do I know that this is true, that God spoke to the people, then you could ask that person, well, what would the criteria be? What would the criteria be which would enable you to be convinced that it actually occurred? What type of criteria are you looking for? And the answer is, if you examine carefully what has been said over here, what the reality is, not to come to the conclusion that what we find in the history of the Jewish people is something which would be impossible for anybody to fabricate, for anybody to engineer. There is no way in which you can convince people to profess that they have been witnesses to something which in point of fact they haven't been witnesses to. That's a impossibility, and whenever that would occur, if people claim to have witnessed something which we would have, you know, reason to suspect, and after we're not convinced of, then there's going to be all kinds of challenges. If something is not true, if something didn't happen. Yet some people, they want to create some type of a scare. They want to claim that there's unidentified flying objects or anything along those lines. If that is the case, it's impossible to get unanimous agreement. There'll always be different opinions. People like to point to the example of this actor, Orson Welles. And there was I don't know how many people have heard about it. There was an incident. He was on radio. He had a radio show years and years ago, comes before the television era. And he created some kind of a scare because he did it as a skit. That Martians were invading and so on and so forth. He was doing it as a joke, but he was a great actor and he was so convincing that people thought he was giving a real report. That is not the idea behind the truth. It's not based upon how many people are going to maintain that something is true. Because as I said yesterday, the fact that people believe something is no indication whatsoever that there's any truth to it, and to the contrary. Generally speaking, the more people believe in something, the more popular it is, the more of an indication that it's really not based upon any kind of truth. Because the majority of people's beliefs and convictions are determined by their feelings, by their emotions. So Judaism does not believe in that at all. To the contrary, that's the whole essence of Abraham, that Abraham was there ha'echad, that Abraham was on one side and the entire world was on the other side. Which means to say that in terms of truth, he discovered the truth, the reality, about the creator of the universe, and as opposed to the idolatrous constructions that people were fabricating in their own minds. He was the only individual in his society, and virtually the only one who was holding a few people in the world who knew about this truth. So that idea that people sometimes say, very often someone will have a very original idea which is extremely unconventional and it goes totally against the tide. So, and most people believe otherwise because that's the accepted truth. So it's very difficult for people to go against that. And they'll say, how is it possible? Let everybody else look at it differently. You'll find it all the time, even in Judaism. If you have an interpretation of Judaism that's different than the mainstream, so to speak, or the conventional. So people have a hard time with that. So what are you saying, Dad? Oh, everybody's wrong. And we maintain that that's not an argument. Yes, okay. Whether the truth of an idea has nothing to do with the amount of people that believe in it. That's totally contrary to the Torah. We don't describe truth to numbers. Something is true or untrue has to do with the phenomena, with the fact, with the logic, with the analysis. And it's very, very possible. Very, very popular throughout all of history. Mankind has made progress because of great people who were independent and they went against the time. And after centuries, it became clear that their ideas. So the fact that you have millions of people believing in something is absolutely no proof whatsoever. Because that would say is extremely positive in the realm of the possible, to convince millions of people to go along with the system and to affirm that an individual has special powers. The other, the Hindu religion, the Eastern religion, for a Buddha, that they believe that he had some divine powers, or he had some revelations, whatever the case may be, the fact, so you'll say, how is it possible? You have millions, maybe billions of people that believe in that. Doesn't that prove something? I say absolutely yes. Because that is something, their connection to Buddha or is purely based upon belief. There is no claim. They have agreed to have, for whatever reason, then, of course, that's in the first generation, every other generation is raised in the brain. Yeah, you have to understand also, in establishing a religion, the difficult thing is essentially in the first generation. To convince enough people, and there's enough people that were not raised in it. So, you're starting from scratch with these individuals, but to convince them to accept the claim that you're making. Now, to do that, then it becomes progressively easier, because there's a certain mechanism that all religions utilize, and that is the indoctrination factor. And that's why you can have, like we have in our society today, extremely intelligent people, extremely rational, logical people in every area, except in the religion, Christianity, for example. When it comes to that, they don't apply the same type of a logical critique that they would apply in any other area. And they just accept on the basis of faith a system of ideas which is logically impossible. The fundamentals of Christianity are something which logic would reject, and they themselves acknowledge it. That it's absurd, that the views are absurd, but it's faith. That's all because of the power of indoctrination. You can really destroy a person's mind in childhood by closing the mind with regard to certain doctrines. And then there's the phenomenon of a certain type of religious guilt that you impose, and that's all religions up there. There's no religion that bases itself upon an investigation that encourages an individual to investigate and only to accept the principles on the basis of using their mind. That's what I explained. You see that now this is different, because you say in the Tzvira, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. So the question that I had raised was, it should simply say Elokei Avraham, God of Avraham. Avraham is the one who made the discovery. He was raised in idolatry. So he was able to penetrate and break through from the indoctrination, the enslavement of that type of an indoctrination. And he was able to free himself and to utilize his own intelligence and to operate purely on the basis of his intelligence. Now, once if that's the case, that was God of Avraham, where Yitzhak received it from his father, and Yaakov received it from his father. So why does he say Elokei Yaakov, as though he too made a discovery? And just very briefly, the answer to that is that Avraham did not employ the system of indoctrination. That he related to them in terms of guiding them on an investigation, so that they should partake of this investigation and to analyze and to study the criteria and to allow them to arrive at the correct conclusion through the utilization of their own free will. So that's Elokei Yitzchak. Yitzchak also came to that conclusion. So that's a totally different concept. And therefore, the fact that all religions can claim that they have millions of people that believe in it, see, well, that's why the idea of proselytizing is vital to all the other religions. All the other religions are operating on the principle that numbers have a certain significance in determining the authenticity, in determining truth. That's why it's extremely important for the Christians to proselytize. The more people believe in it, the more they can feel secure that it's true. And we reject that idea completely. Of course, the most important target of the proselytizing is the Jews themselves, because they know that the Jews are the ones to whom the revelation was given. And the Jews are the big holdouts and say that everything they're claiming is absolutely false. So that's why the Jews have always been the target. Proselytizing. So let's just make it clear the foundation of Torah Nisiyan and the fact that this story, as recorded in the Torah, is attested to by hundreds of thousands of people, is we accept that as a verification, because what they're saying is that they witnessed phenomena that at a certain point in time the entire nation was gathered at Sinai, and they witnessed the phenomena that is described in the Torah, which could leave no doubt whatsoever that the Supreme Being was communicating with them. That's the foundation of our system, And there is no other people that make that kind of a claim. And as I'm trying to explain, there's a good reason for that, and that is because it's an impossibility to create this type of phenomenon. It's an impossibility to convince masses of people that they witnessed something which would be very favorable to you if you could convince them. As I said, no religious charlatan, no political leader who wanted millions of people to believe in him, to believe that he has some divine dispensation. They can only operate on other different types of methods to try and manipulate people's emotions. I mean, you could have a Hitler in the Maximo who had millions of Germans, millions and millions of believing in him. But he could not get them to do so on the basis of a claim that they themselves were witnessed when some supernatural event occurred. And that it couldn't do it. No other individual ever even attempted to do it because he'd get laughed out of the box. It's an impossibility. We don't have that kind of control. And even in Soviet Russia, with all the control, with all the propaganda, no one ever managed to establish something like that, that people would actually testify that they themselves witnessed. An event which was supernatural in nature, which was the proof beyond doubt that they have to follow a certain doctrine, and that they would then teach their children and pass on this truth. A whole nation would pass on a history that they themselves have witnessed, to pass it on to their children and to the next generation. This phenomenon has never ever occurred in history. The phenomenon that we find in Judaism, that the Jewish people has always maintained the Torah as being an accurate description of what took place, of what their origins were. The events in Egypt and so on and so forth, all the events of the Torah now become compelling because this is the history that was, no one can question it. There's no one that got that, but the Jews. But the Jews accepted the Torah, the entire nation accepted the Torah, there's no one that denies that. But they failed to see the implications of what this means, because again, you've got to get back to the same basic point. Did these events occur, or did they not occur? And if you maintain that they did not occur, and the entire thing is fiction, then what you have to say is that at a certain point in time, some individual was able to achieve something which has never ever been able to, that is demonstrated as an impossibility. We come to this people and somehow or other manage to convince an entire people to accept a new history of itself. In other words, it was a different history. It was not the history that you read. And at a certain point in time, somebody entered into the picture and was able to convince the entire people to give up whatever history they had and to accept a completely different history. That we say is an impossibility. Nobody ever tried it. If somebody did try it, maybe even two people, you definitely would be hearing an argument. There definitely would have to be some kind of a record from those of you who disagree. Or there was a war broke out and they were killed, whatever the case may be. So, again, it's important to realize what the foundation of our belief that the origin of the Torah, is not something which people just believe in because we had a charismatic individual and he claimed to listen to God and people believe that of him. Not the case. The entire nation witnessed this event and made this a part of their history, which was transmitted to the entire nation. And there's not one voice of dissent has been reported. Not one faction that says it didn't occur. There's been different factions among the Jews in terms of like these stupid about the Torah of Asav, Torah of Al-Peh, that type of an issue. Because that's fine, because to have such a thing, because that is not something which is visible. That's something you can argue about. But even the Tzedukim did not deny the divinity of the Torah. That they did not. But how should you interpret it? That's something which is possible for people who want to distort the situation. I explained to you yesterday why a person's intelligence is irrational, and yes, it's an a Torah Shebaal Peh as well. But the fact that you have an argument concerning that is not any kind of a disproof, because the truth of the matter is that all these groups accepted the divinity of the Torah Shebaal Peh. That's a such a kind of argument. Questions being raised, what about if the people who are witnessed and so forth, what about the backsliding that took place? That is to say, the rebellion, the Jews continued to rebel. Bear in mind one thing, that in all of the rebellions, you never find any situation where the people who rebelled were saying, well, why should we follow the Torah? We know what Moses is saying is false. We never heard it from God. That's never questioned. What we're saying is that the purpose of Sinai was to establish the foundation. But the people should not have to base themselves on some kind of a blind faith. And it addresses the issue of how do I know that the system I'm supposed to live by comes from God? That's the most fundamental question with regard to Torah. Of course, there are two different steps in the process. The first thing is study Torah properly. Then you see yourself, the Torah is an expression of the wisdom that has to have a source. And the source of the Torah is a being of infinite wisdom. That's a separate idea. That is that just like a scientist studies nature and recognizes that the wisdom embodied in nature comes from some supreme being, superior being. The same is true with regard to the Torah study. However, people don't start out on that level. That would be first-hand knowledge. A person reaches a level where he can see the profundity of Torah, that this is a system of infinite cosmos, so that's encouraged up becomes a dumpster. In the same way that a scientist studies science, and if he's not like Einstein, he comes to recognize that there must be a force outside of the universe that's responsible for this wisdom that he encounters. So you'll say, if that's the case, then why do you accept the truth? Why don't we just study Torah and give a quick compliment to Torah is divine wisdom, so everybody will study Torah and everybody will come to that conclusion. The answer to that is that you need a foundation. But it takes many, many years, and not everybody is on that level of intellectual ability, that they can study Torah on that level. So therefore, this kind of an awareness, this kind of insight is not apparent at the very beginning. So you gotta create the impetus. What's my basis for accepting the Torah? That's kind of like what the Nasa and the Mishnah type of thing. But Nasa, first we have to accept the Torah, first we have to commit ourselves to keeping the system and keeping the mitzvot and Talmud Torah studying. And yes, you do everything that God describes, and you'll come to the point where you will see that it's true because of the wisdom in the Torah itself. Rakam Chacham V'Navam, Hazayadar Lazar. So, the proof is needed in order to make the basic commitment to establish the fact that the system that we are receiving, that when we first receive it, we can't analyze it, we can't see its divinity from the system itself. But you need secondary knowledge, so to speak. You need proof that there are two ways in which you can ascertain the truthfulness of any kind of a work, any kind of a composition. Two ways. One is through the study of the thing itself. If you're trained, you can understand physics, you're Einstein, so you'll be able to see the truth in the theory. But let's say you can't. There's another way that you can ascertain the truth of a work, and that is you know the author. You know that this author is the greatest physicist, and then you know that this work has tremendous value.
But you know, there are two ways you can ascertain the truthfulness of Torah. One is through the ability to analyze the ideas of the Torah. But there's another way, and that is, you know, who the author is. So that's very, very vital. At the outset, a person has to know before they launch, before they make the effort to really study the Torah in depth and to unravel the ideas, then they're only going to do so if they're convinced that it's worth their while. So therefore, the purpose of the Sinai experience is to establish the authorship where the Torah comes from. And once you know that, now it's the Mishnah. You see, now the commitment that you're making is a rational commitment. It's based upon logic. Now the idea that each person, each generation should accept it as though he was there, in my opinion, is explained by what we just did. That is to say, that when it comes to the veracity of a historical event, there really is no difference, in my opinion. If something is firmly established in a manner that no rational person would deny, as I've explained, that World War I occurred, that the Revolutionary War occurred, and that nobody entertains any doubt whatsoever about it. And there's many different opinions as to the interpretation. I'm not talking about the interpretation, but everybody, all of the English people, all of the American people, there's not, as far as I know, I'm sure there are troops in the world, but no serious individual has any doubt about it. And I maintain that there is no difference. There is no difference between the conviction that this event occurred, between those who actually experienced it, and between those who only know about it through history. So therefore, as far as I am concerned, with regard to the question as to whether the Revolutionary War occurred, there is no difference between me and between those who experienced it, and it's clear to me as if I was there myself. With regard to Torah also, there is no difference between the conviction of those who actually experienced it and the conviction of all the generations afterwards, because we know that it had to have occurred, otherwise it would have been impossible for an entire nation to pass this down as their history. So I am just as convinced that the Ma'amad al-Sinai occurred exactly as it's described in the Torah, as I am that there was a Revolutionary War, that there was a World War I, that there was a War of Independence for Israel in 1948. There's no doubt in my mind, and I don't feel any need or any desire to have actually been there, somehow or other, really see it, so to speak. There's a way we could go back in history, put that in event, and then to actually be part of those who experienced it, if that were possible. I would not feel the need. I may feel the desire to observe a certain historical event out of curiosity, but not because I'm not convinced that it occurred. And I think everybody would agree to that. Is anybody not convinced that there was a Holocaust? And that you're saying, well, if I could actually have been there, then I mean, then I'd be more convinced. Is anyone saying that? Does anybody maintain that you're not really convinced about the Revolutionary War, that it occurred? And somehow or other you can arrange for me to go back in time, if that were possible, then that would strengthen my conviction. I don't think anybody would say that. To the contrary, unless you have some big interest in the event itself, you probably would say it's a waste of my time. I'm not interested in the Revolutionary War. So in that manner, in that sense, God established something that would be enduring for every generation, because indeed that was the objective, that God did not want a person to go into this blindly. God wanted a person to know, to have intellectual conviction that the origin of the Torah is from God himself. The question is being raised, what about an atheist or an unbeliever that does not accept the veracity of the event? I would say that if you listen, if the person, first of all, not everybody's fully aware of the implications. This is not so simple. When the Torah speaks about this in general terms, there are very few people that have transformed this into an actual elucidation, into an actual exposition of the proof, in the form of the proof. I think that's clear. I think nobody's been taught it that way in school. But what the Torah is talking about is something which, if you analyze it, actually forms the basis of the proof, and then you have to go into what constitutes historical knowledge. That was, I think, one of the first philosophers to formulate that way was the Kizari. So bear in mind, a lot of people say, well, if that's the case, how come there's many Jews today don't believe in the Torah? Well, the answer is they don't understand what the truth is. They haven't thought about it. So they just think that it's something that's in a book. It's basically the way we were all raised. When you read the parsha in the Torah, you said, well, okay, that's the Torah. That's the story. That's the story. Well, but do I know that the story really occurs? And you didn't make the logical connections on the basis of the fact that there is criteria by which we accept things in history. So there are many people that are not aware of what we're talking about. They just think it's a book, and the book was accepted by a lot of people, and it's no different. They don't see it as being any different than Christianity. They accept this story. It's miracle, so you accept this miracle. They didn't recognize the difference that over here what you have is witnesses. Masses of people testifying that they were the ones who were there, that they actually saw it. Yet, when you try and give this exposition, there are still people that really refuse to accept it. You have to understand the emotions play a very significant role. And I think the psychologists call it some kind of a cognitive dissonance. That is, that when it comes to this area, there are very strong resistances that people do not want there to be any type of a proof because they don't like to read the results. The results imply, I mean, if you accept it as being true, then it's a whole different universe that you're living in. And so, without the proof, so you have a certain psychological freedom. Even religious people don't like it, because they like the idea that we're having faith. They think they're doing God a favor by having faith. But it also provides a certain freedom. You don't have to feel let down by it. You lose a lot of guilt because of letting go of the truth. So there's a very strong desire amongst many religious people, just like non-religious people, that the Torah should be something which is in a different realm. As I explained to you at the outset, this is assimilation. The result of assimilation, that the Torah should be in a realm where it's something that we really can't say for sure that it's true. Because once you are committed, once it's very clear to you that it's from God, you kind of don't have too much room. You don't have any space. You got to keep it. What choice do you have? Therefore, the atheist will make up all different types. We can't deny the basics. Nobody can deny the basis that you are obligated to come to the conclusion that masses of people testify that they saw this. So then they start to make up all kinds of concoctions. Well, how do you know it was really from God? Maybe they were Martians. Maybe Moshe was able to hypnotize the people and so forth. Well, even though we heard the other day that maybe Moshe was able to conjure something and they heard some kind of... All of these things, which essentially are denial. That is, if you're going to say that, bear in mind, if you're going to say that maybe they were confused, maybe somebody faked them out, maybe this, maybe that, if all of these things are essentially saying we have to deny that this group of people had any ability to ascertain on the basis of their sense perceptions what reality was. Because these people had no ability to ascertain reality. First of all, that's absolutely absurd. You're talking about people, but it's not just people. I mean, the Jews have been known throughout history to be an astute people. And a stubborn people, and a rebellious people. So how can you get this entire group of people to tell the story? But if that is the case, if you're going to maintain that, then I say that you have to reject all of this. Because why don't you say the same thing about any event? Why don't you say that you can always find conspiracies? There are people about conspiracies. You could say there was a conspiracy to convince people that there was a war. A conspiracy. Because there is no way, as I said, that anybody can experience firsthand World War I. There's no way you can do it. You're going to have to rely on other people's testimony. Even a soldier that was in Europe at that time, he didn't see World War I, or he didn't see World War II, he just thought he was going to fight. The fact that we're sitting in the missing pieces, this is part of a worldwide thing, and all the different alliances and so on and so forth, no one person witnessed that. That comes together from many, many people testifying. That while you were there, other people testified that they were professionals in Japan in World War II. How did you know who was part of World War II, which engulfed the entire world? All he saw was one little battle. So, man, he doesn't even know where he was. How did he know he was in Japan? You can say that it was all conspiracy. So, if you're going to... Now, nobody knows the same person who's going to seriously report these things. Therefore, there is nothing that an atheist can do except to start to break down the essential categories and to posit. Yeah, because I told you yesterday that anything is possible. You can say whatever you want. You can say it's possible. No. You could say, if you were there, if you witnessed Kriya Shamsa, you could say it's possible, like there were forces of nature and so on and so forth that caused them to split, and then these water came together, and it was just good luck that the Jews were the ones that were saved, and they were then, so they were all saved. You can twist any set of facts in any manner you want, but that is distortion. The atheist, essentially, will have to engage in a distortion. And because there's no way that you can deny the fact that this group of people is testifying that this is what they saw. That's as far as you need to go, by the way. That is to say that the story which the Torah describes over here is something which you have to accept as being true. True in the sense that these people are saying, you can't get past that. When we say you accept it as true, we're accepting the fact, we're accepting the account as it is presented to us in the Torah. And the entire nation is telling us that they were there. Meaning to say, you are in the position, let me see if I can create a better example. You are in the position today. Let's say that you had 2 million. 2 million Jews in the land of Israel. Now let's say that a similar thing occurs. A Rosh Shavuos, 2 million, 3 million Jews. No, let's say all the Jews in Israel. Let's put it that way. All the people in Israel. We gather together at the site of the Yerushalayim. And the same things occur. The fire went up to heaven, the thick clouds, and the shofar, they heard the voice from heaven proclaiming that the Torah is true. And the second revelation. Now, we were not there. We were here. And all these people came and told us, you guys can get them into an amphitheater, whatever the case may be. And they all told us that this is what they saw. And there's not one, whether they're people, religious, Muslim, or whatever you want to call it, all said the same story. That's what we saw. So, what would be the logical conclusion? Wouldn't you be forced to conclude that everything that they're saying is true? And then you have to examine what they claim, there's no doubt in what is actually happening. Now, the only question would be whether what they're actually saying has any significance to it. Is this incontrovertible proof that a supreme being communicated with them? That's the situation which we find ourselves. With regard to the Sinai, this occurred to a group of Jews in one generation, millions of Jews, and it's as though we're not there. they're telling it to us. As though the same thing I just mentioned right now, that over Shavuot, all of Israel claimed that they were united at the Yatoka. And if you have the same question, you have to step over the side, because are you going to believe that the leftists and the non-religious and the atheists were somehow duped into telling the story? Everybody's telling the same story. So then you have to accept that it actually occurred. And then all that would remain was to evaluate, okay, well, what is it implying though? I can't deny that it happened. What's the implication? That's what the significance of the Tanakh story is. As far as the question made by Mark about backsliders, the amazing thing is that you never find any instance in the Torah or even in Tanakh or any kind of a movement that rebelled against Judaism, rebelled against Moshe on the basis that the whole thing is not his own thing, that it never happened. Our parents never told us, so you never. But the event of Torah Mishnah does not obliterate the human psyche. People still have free choice. And people still have very, very powerful emotions. So therefore, when they encounter difficulties in the wilderness and they become weary, and then they'd be bad. And then they would distort. But they didn't deny the Torah. They would complain that Moshe Rabbeinu was making mistakes, he was leading us to destruction, it can't be the will of God. Things of that sort. Under the pressure of fears, anxieties, the miraculous. The miraculous, when they came to the land, that they were overcome by fear. They didn't then go back and deny the Torah, but they allow themselves to be overcome by their emotions, and they're not going to bear it. The phenomenon of Torah Mishnah is not designed to prevent people from sinning. You need free will. And even a person that's absolutely convinced that Torah will sin. It says in Torah that there's no person that does good in this world that only does good and doesn't sin. Even a person that believes in the Torah sins, because that's just the way the psyche functions, that there's only a clash. Just because a person knows that something is harmful doesn't mean there's nothing to do with it. People know that smoking is harmful doesn't mean they're not going to smoke. People know that alcoholism is dangerous doesn't mean they're not going to do it. That's a different issue. That's a different issue, but as I said, there's plenty of areas in life where a person can rebel. But you do not find that anybody ever rebelled against the foundation and claimed that it didn't occur. Any other area that the Jews committed in history, even of Avodah Zarah, does not in any way weaken the basis of the proof. The proof, once the entire people testifies that they were Sinai, that means that the event occurred. You have to accept the event of occurred. There's something else, the fact that people at that time or future generations, will they live in accordance with what they know to be true, or will they backslide and be diminished? That does not in any way detract from the testimony. It would be like people testify that they directly witnessed some type of a hazard, some type of a danger. And there's no reason to doubt their story. And then you'll see that they didn't say, and therefore on the basis because of what they witnessed, they're issuing certain warnings that you shouldn't do certain things. And then it could be that some of the people were here, and we can't doubt it, so we take it seriously. Then you can see that these very same people are engaging in the behavior. If they themselves are the source for the warning not to engage in it. So they're not being consistent. The fact of the matter is that there's no subsequent behavior which indicates that the Jews abandoned the Torah. There was great sinning, and
There were generators. There were sinners amongst the Jews. There were deniers amongst the Jews. There's no question about that. Because these are individuals who were overcome by their emotions, and when they're overcome by their emotions, so they distorted it, and they said that the emotion made a mistake on a certain point. They did this distortion. This could not be the intention of the Torah. For example, like Korah. This is part of Korah. You know that whole chazal that they came to Moshe with these talisos that were all playless, and they ridiculed his answer, but they didn't deny telling the sinner. Or if you have a shayim. You have a shayim that wanted to live an instinctual life, and they chose not to be rational about the Torah. That doesn't disprove. That does not disprove. That the only question is, and the same question you could ask today, the Reform Jews today, that deny the Torah. But the question is, what went wrong in terms of the educational system that would convince them out of this approach? But there's no way you can undo a historical event. There's no way to undo a historical event. There's no way that you can prevent people from sinning as long as they retain emotions and they have free will. Then it's a personal battle. If God were to again stage, orchestrate a revelation, public revelation, to millions and millions of people throughout the world, and they were all convinced on that day that this was from God, that would be no guarantee that in a very short amount of time they could be acting totally contrary to what they know to be true. Because the only thing that protects a person is if he studies Torah. Let's ask ourselves this, what do we have to do? Why do you have to give all the mitzvahs, and why do you have to give all the commands to study the Torah and to do tshuva and to work on yourself? Because the fact that you're convinced that God appeared, if you don't internalize that, that's why miracles. That's another weakness in miracles. A person may experience the most powerful miracle, and it's going to wear off. The effect is going to wear off. If he does not internalize it, if you don't internalize it, and uproot the emotions that are opposed to it and work on yourself and achieve perfection, you're going to be an imperfected individual. If you're an imperfected individual, you're going to operate in accordance with your emotional desires. That's what Moshe warned them. This is the foundation. As I said, this is the foundation. But then they also say that what does this have to lead to? Now, I said an ishma. If you don't act on it, I'm giving you something that if you use your intelligence, you'll be able to see that it comes from me. This book comes from me. But if you don't act on it, and you just ignore the book, and you don't do what the book commands, which is not an easy task. You have to study. You have to do the mitzvahs. You have to work on yourself. You have to turn to God. You have to wear the tefillin. What's the tefillin? So you should be constantly reminded of this truth. If you don't do these things, so then, the whole effect of the Mamar Asiyah is going to be lost. Mamar Asiyah is there for an intelligent person, like the Amnesia says, the Torah was given to another. And you see in every area, you could have the greatest handbook, guidebook in any area, medicine, and other areas of human concern, it doesn't matter, and everybody can be completely convinced that this is the road. This is the right road. But if you don't study the book, if you don't internalize and live by it, so then you're not going to get the benefit of it. So that's what Moshe says. This is the starting point. Sinai is the starting point. But Sinai in and of itself is not a magical pillar. And therefore the nation has to act on that. I've given you the benefit of Atar Ezra Adar. That's why he's telling them, now Shemor Nafshcha Ma'od, you don't forget what you saw, and implement it, and build on it, until you reach the level where you are keeping it because you recognize the benefits and you see the truth. But if you don't do that, then of course you're going to sin. Of course you're going to want to serve Avodah Zarah, you're going to talk emotion. So Sinai itself is no guarantee that people are going to be perfected. It's the starting point for perfection. But it's whether or not it'll lead to that, whether or not the sins that the Jews committed were not an indication of the fact that the foundation wasn't strong enough, wasn't authentic enough. You don't see any of that. They're very, very authentic, very powerful. But now, what do you do next? Where do you go from there? The fact that a person believes in something, is convinced about something, and something is part of their value, is not a guarantee that they never will sin or even violate the terms. People will violate the terms of their marriage. People can be believers of Torah, and they can get caught up. That's the human condition. But you always have to be on guard. And that's why you'll find religious leaders, even righteous people. And the Tanakh describes many righteous people that committed averos and many serious averos. David HaMelech, for example, and others who were righteous people. Now, are we going to say that, well, you see David sin, so therefore you obviously didn't accept the Torah? That's absurd. It means to say that that's a different issue. That as long as you're human, you're under the sway of a different principle, where there could be a tremendous gap between your knowledge of the good, your knowledge of reality, and your emotional desire of the moment, and therein lies the human battle, the battle, the Milchemas HaChayim, the war of life. And there is absolutely nothing in the behavior of the Jews or the individuals that can in any way, shape, or form make any change whatsoever with regard to the fact that the nation itself, if you study the history of this event, there's no question that you have to accept this event as being authentic. Now, will the nation act upon that? That's the whole challenge of Jewish history, Maas Avin Ishma. That's what God is saying. I've given you the opportunity. I've made it clear to you. But if you don't work on this every day, if you don't take this, and that's why he wrote Tishkach, that's the warning of Moshe Rabbeinu. If you allow yourself to effectuate a change, if you don't perfect yourself, if you don't follow all of the mitzvahs and all of the reminders, then it will fade away like anything else. It'll be just a minimal experience, like people experience miracles, foxholes. There's no atheist in the foxhole. People go through tremendous experiences and where they were on the verge of being killed. Soldiers. See, the craziest set of circumstances that were somehow saved, and all that time that died, and then convinced that it's a miracle. Convinced that it's a miracle. You've heard this, you've all heard people who are convinced that it has to be a miracle. Does this mean that 5 years later they're living perfected lives? Because at the moment they were convinced, they gave tremendous hodeah, tremendous praise, acknowledgement, thanksgiving to Hashem Baruch Hu. And they were convinced that their whole life was going to be changed. So the question is, if a person experiences an event which creates a very powerful sense that God has done something for him, and in that moment of time, he's fully convinced, committed that he's going to keep the Torah, and so on and so forth, is that, can we, on the basis of that, can we be sure that 5 years later this person will be living a righteous existence? No. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. The key question is, what does he do with the experience? If he allows that experience to just operate on its own, and it'll fade away. Because there's no automatic change. The structure of a human being and all of his emotional desires and his fears, everything, unless it's going to be upgraded, reoriented on the basis of the knowledge, then he's going to be the same person, and the effect will wear off. So the effect of Sinai can wear off too. But it never wore off in terms of the nation. It never wore off because it became a permanent fixture in the life of the nation. So therefore, how is that possible? Now, is the nation living up? Is it aware of its own history? Is it living up to the implications of its own historical truth? Unfortunately, no. There's always going to be, there is a second. I mean, those are the ones that keep the Torah. There is a second. But that doesn't change anything. Because there's no way you can refute history. You can't change history. There's no way today that anybody can change the history of the United States that it did not originate from the Revolutionary War. It can't be changed. It's there. The testimony is there. It's established. And no way it could be changed. You can't go back and change it. There's no way you can change the account of the event of Sinai.